Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
We've got UFC 264 coming up this weekend. Really excited for it. As always, one half of your host, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP. You can find him there on their respective socials. His first name's Matt. His last name's Allen. FNP is just a formality. But Matt, we have a huge card coming up this weekend. UFC 264, the trilogy. Poirier, McGregor, the first fight at featherweight about 7 years ago. Then the rematch was just back in January at the tail end on the 23rd. Dustin Poirier picking up an early TKO victory where he pretty well shut McGregor's lights out. I know it was a TKO and I know the referee stopped in, but there were some unanswered shots, hence the finish. But overall, big time card coming up. McGregor's next steps are really on the line in this one, because for Dustin Poirier, obviously the number one ranked contender at lightweight at this current juncture, McGregor ranked fifth. We'll see how that shakes out in the coming weeks. But listen, this is a big time card for these two guys too.
This is a massive card. And although it might not have any titles on the line, just the main event, I know we talk about crossroad fights as in, oh, there's an up and coming fighter against sort of a more well-known veteran, but this is a really important fight, like you had mentioned, for the career of Conor McGregor, because let's just get this out of the way. If you lose to Dustin Poirier again, okay, you lose twice to Dustin Poirier in 2020, 2021, no real big deal. He's a very, very good fighter. But if you're Conor McGregor and you lose to Dustin Poirier twice, then it really is going to be a huge question mark as to, okay, how big is your star appeal now? Because you've lost a few of your last fights. People don't really remember you as being that killer that you once were back in 2016. So this is a really, really important fight, really, for the organization this weekend.
And for Conor McGregor, his last win in the lightweight division was at UFC 205. He became the double champ. He got the win over Eddie Alvarez. That was November 12th, 2016. The Billboard Top 100 song of the Jour was Closer by Halsey and the Chainsmokers. That's how long ago it's been. Now listen, that plays a lot in the Spotify playlist. I still hear that song today, but it has been a long time since McGregor's been in the win column for Dustin Poirier. His last time out was, well, in the rematch in January. But overall, a really, really big card. And let's throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. These are the fights that you definitely do not want to miss. You don't want to go to the bathroom. You don't want to go run out for snacks. Skip the dishes, DoorDash, whatever you have to do. These are the big ones you're not going to want to miss. The screen is, as always, presented by Manscaped. Check them out, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNB. You're going to save 20% off free shipping. Let's throw it on over to the fight of the night screen. When we're talking about a possible fight of the night, how could we go any further than the welterweight division? We have a couple of big welterweight fights. Bang, bang. They also happen to be our potential fight of the nights. But you've got Max Payne Griffin, taking on the natural-born killer in Carlos Condit, a guy who has way more finish wins than he has by decision. But lately, a couple of really big wins his last two times out, and he was on a tidy. Now, normally I say tidy little win streak. He was on a tidy little losing streak before getting these last two wins over notable names in Court McGee and Matt Brown, both by decision. For Max Payne Griffin, two wins in a row as well. Ramiz Brahimi and then Sung Kanon. But listen, he finished them in emphatic fashion. This one should deliver.
To quote Tony Ferguson when he was talking to Fabrizio Verdun, let me take it from here, brother. This is what we do. Every weekend, there's about three, maybe four fights that could be fight of the night contenders. But when two fighters fight, and those guys are Matt Brown and Carlos Condit, I make sure that those guys get the respect they deserve. And for Carlos Condit, this is a really important fight this weekend. Like, we've seen you against the upper levels of competition at this stage in your career, and you can't really hang it with them at 37. But he's looked really good in his last two fights. And yes, looking good against Court McGee and Matt Brown mean a different thing than looking good against, like, Usman. But still, he's looked better as of late, and against an opponent who's super game in Max Griffin, this should completely deliver. I'm so excited for this fight.
The best part for Carlos Condit, since he beat those two guys, Matt Brown went on to knock out Diego Lima, and Court McGee went out to beat Claudio Silva, so that's great. And for Max Griffin, well, Ramiz Brahimi hasn't fought since, and Sung Kanon hasn't either. But still, nonetheless, very good wins over opponents that you want to see Max Griffin winning against. This is a very big fight. And if we want to stick to the topic of the conversation of very big fights, Nico Price, the hybrid, taking on Michelle Pereira, Demolidor. Matt, it's not often that you see fighters at welterweight, period, that are under the age of 32 with this much pro experience. And then couple the fact that both of these guys have 2 no contests on their record. It's absolutely insane. For Michelle Pereira, came into the UFC, head of steam, beat Hot Chocolate Danny Roberts, loses 2 in a row. And then he gets wins over Zalim Imadaev and Chaos Williams. For Nico Price, alternates wins and losses. Last time out, had that really weird fight where it was a majority draw, but then it ends up a no contest because Nico Price likes to smoke dope. So we end up here. And if you're smoking the weed, just be careful. And we don't want any no contests out of that. And if you're, whether you're a track and field runner or a fighter, just don't do it. But in this fight, Matt, Nico Price, Michelle Pereira, if it ends up a win, lose, draw, or no contest, it should be a good one.
Throw out the rules, throw out USADA, throw out the judges. Like, you can eliminate quite a bit of the UFC's work for them with this fight. I doubt the judges are going to be needed. These are two guys who love going out there, going for the knockout, going in for the submission, too. And the really cool thing about Nico Price is the fact that everyone does know him for the striking. He is a really good grappler, too. A lot of submission wins on his record as well. And I do think that this will be a really, really fun fight.
I'm really looking forward to this one. Obviously for Nico Price, the majority draws last time out against Donald Cerrone, but he did look really good in that fight. Before that, a loss to Vicente Luque. We're talking about some big names. And for Michelle Pereira, he's winning fights the way that you want him to win them. Like, he submitted Zalim Imadaev, and then after that fights Chaos Williams in a back and forth type of fight where neither guy really engaged, but it was a smart fight for sure from Pereira, who's still only 27 years old. So I absolutely love this fight. Can't wait for it. 2 great fights in the fight of the night screen. Again, make sure you check out manscaped.com. Use promo code, our promo code, FNP. You're going to save 20% off and get free shipping. We have a big card coming up this weekend. And lots of exciting things going on in the world of Fight Night Picks, but not just Fight Night Picks. Make sure you check out the Allen Brothers at 15-minute card breaks over on Twitter and Instagram. 15-minute card breaks. We're having fun with it. We're taping a lot of them, maybe at the same time, but in our first ever episode, we're going to be cracking a couple of Panini Prism blaster boxes. So check out that video there. You're not going to want to miss what we open up in these boxes. We're going to have a lot more great content over there. If you're a sports card fan, make sure you check it out. I'll put a link below in the description as well as a card up there up top. If you want to support the boys, get that subscriber train rolling. We really would appreciate a like and a sub on this video as well. If you like the content, the Fight Night Pick stuff that we have coming out, all sorts of great interviews out there, all sorts of great podcasts as well. So you can find us at Fight Night Picks, at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. But Matt Allen FNP, we got one hell of a card coming up this week. UFC 264. You're not going to want to miss any of that Fight Night Picks content. Just keep locked in with the boys. And as we always say, let's get into it. I'm going to start this video off in a totally different way than I've ever started a Fight Night Picks video, because really weird fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have North Macedonia's own Alan Amadovsky. He's going to be taking on China's Hu Yaozhong, and his nickname is Totoro. Listen, I don't know if you watched the cartoon growing up or the anime. I should say anime. If I offended anybody, I apologize. I actually quite enjoyed it. Watched it in my teenage years. It was pretty good, but for Hu Yaozhong, this guy has one of the weirdest records, and he's overall one of the weirdest fighters to be in the UFC. And if you don't believe me, we don't have to look very much further than his record. He's 3-2 overall, lost his 2 fights in the UFC. Of his 3 fights that he won on the Chinese regional scene, and I have them here for you, the opponent's combined record was 2-4 at the time, and his last win was December 2nd of 2016. The weirdest part about it is the fact that on the regional scene, he fought at heavyweight. Well, then he comes into the UFC and he fights Cyril Asker. He weighed in at 232 pounds for that fight. He ends up losing by submission. That was Cyril Asker's last win in the UFC. He would go on to lose to one Tai Tuivasa that's also on this card. So then Hu Yaozhong decides, I'm going to move down to light heavyweight. Weighs in exactly on the nose at 205 pounds. Fights Rashad Coulter, who weighs in at 208 pounds. They have him knock him out, drag him out type of fight. It was very close. A few people gave it to Hu Yaozhong, but the majority gave it to Rashad Coulter. Coulter gets the win, but then he's no longer in the UFC. So Hu Yaozhong, his last fight was against Rashad Coulter. And I wrote it down here because the first fight was on the Bisping Gaslam card. To give you an idea, it was November of 2017. The next card was November of 2018. That was the last time we saw Hu Yaozhong in the octagon almost 3 years ago. Now, the weirdest part about it is he has that first fight at heavyweight. The second fight he weighs in right on the middleweight limit. This fight is at middleweight. This is his first ever fight at middleweight. So I don't know if Hu Yaozhong is China's Jared Cannonier. Maybe the power is going to carry. If you go to the UFC site, they consider him a striker. If you watch him fight in his regional scene fights, which there's three wins, but the quality of opponent isn't great. He mixes in wrestling with his grappling, and he has decent striking, but his cardio wasn't very good. The one thing I want to say about him, Matt, before I hand it off, and it is a bit loaded, so bear with me a little bit. This is going to be your nugget. If you show up to a party on the weekend, if you're sitting at T-Mobile Arena, this is what you can tell your friends. So Hu Yaozhong's been 3 years away. He's been training with Li Jingliang and China Top Team. If you look over on his Instagram, there's nothing. Hu Yaozhong's not an Instagram guy. But if you go to China Top Team, you can see him drilling his wrestling. And he kind of looks a little cut up at 185. Like, physically, he does look really good. I know even in his debut, Dan Hardy and the crew were kind of saying, hey, he's a small heavyweight. But this is where it gets really weird. So what I normally do if it's a fighter that I'm not overly sure of, or if it's a guy like Hu Yaozhong, I took the characters next to his name on Tapology. I threw them into Google. I translated it. I read an article from Sohu.com. Now, again, realize that this is translated, but I'm going to read directly from it. I'm going to pop it up on screen. He said, and this is a quote, again, translated, "I think the middleweight is more suitable for me regardless of size, strength, or other aspects will have some advantages," Hu Yaozhong told reporters about the reasons for the change. He emphasized that his recent preparations have been good, so on and so forth, but although the strength will definitely be smaller than the weight before weight loss, I don't have any discomfort now. He continues on to say, "I've received his help from Li Jingliang." That's great. Then you scroll down a little bit more. "Due to visa issues, Hu Yaozhong's coaching team will not be able to travel with him this time, and the date of the Chinese giant's entry to the United States has been postponed to July 6th, which means that 5 days before the game, the time difference is I have to overcome the problem as much as possible. The trip indeed is a bit rushed, but there is no way. I also want to go early." All of that scares me away from Hu Yaozhong because I haven't seen him in the cage in almost 3 years. His coaching team's not going to be there. He's been training with Li Jingliang, who might make the trip with him, but I don't know. And out of a translated article, it's really weird. Matt, Alan Amadovsky's been bad in the UFC. He got 30-25 and 30-26 by Christoph Jacko in his debut. He got knocked out in 16 seconds by the captain, Wales' own John Phillips. I've talked a lot, but Hu Yaozhong is the biggest mystery in the UFC right now.
I don't think this is going to be a great fight for what it's worth. Now, let me throw in a few more X factors and make it a little bit fancier than just saying that. For Hu Yaozhong, I don't know what he does well. You've kind of beaten around it, but that just really is the honest truth. Like, the UFC has him as a striker, and I trust that he is a striker, but he incorporates wrestling so much into his overall MMA game that when I look at Hu Yaozhong fight, I don't look at him in my mind's eye as a striker. I do see him as a fighter who really does need to mix in his wrestling to be successful, and I say that I thought he would have to do that at the heavyweight division, and then you see him struggle with other grapplers at the heavyweight division, so maybe him dropping this weight could be the best thing going. It does worry me a little bit, because the thing about Jared Cannonier was that he just lost fat, really, when he went down from heavyweight to light heavyweight to middleweight. Like, Jared Cannonier is as muscle-filled as a fighter can possibly get. He's basically a bigger Paulo Costa, to be completely honest, and But the one thing he never talked about was that he was going to lose strength as he was cutting the weight. He never lost muscle. He always kept the one thing that made him special, even at the heavyweight division. And for Hu Yaozhong, it does concern me a little bit that he has openly said, like, hey, I've had to not only lose fat, I've had to lose muscle as well. Because if he is a fighter who is going to have to go in there and get the takedown to really open up his offensive game, I don't really know if he's still going to be able to do that at middleweight. And it is weird because he will be the bigger fighter against some guys. But when you do let go some of that muscle off of your frame, I don't know if he'll always be the strongest fighter. So I don't know if Hu Yaozhong is a fighter who, wow, he used to fight at heavyweight, now he's a middleweight. Wow, he's going to be so much bigger than guys. I really do see this as just being his weight division. Like, when he was at 205, honestly, he looked like a 205er. Well, you had mentioned, he does look kind of cut up, but it will be really interesting to see what he looks like on the scale. I'm not going to throw out like a, oh, save my prediction for question mark kicks, but my official prediction might be heavily swayed depending on how he does look Friday.
For Alan Amadovsky, you go back, you look at him in Bellator, it's weird because he fought all the way up till 2015, then he didn't fight from 2015 to 2018. He rung off 3 wins with Magnum and then 2 with Bellator, all of them by finish. And the last 2 that he had were first round knockouts over Will F. and Flurry. And a guy who, listen, I don't know if a win over Ibrahim Mane means a lot, but to beat him in, what was it, 12 seconds, 14 seconds, like Amadovsky did, it was 14. He just kind of walks in boxing range and just lets his hands fly. And it's a little, what would we say, wonky, I guess?
It's a very 50-50 style of fighting. Like, Alan Amadovsky, every fight is basically a flip of the coin. Either he's going to land a big flurry and win, or he's going to get hit by a big shot and lose. And against Christoph Jocko, it wasn't really that, but it was just a guy with really good technique against primarily a brawler. And if you do have good technique and footwork, you're going to be a step or even two steps ahead of just that brawler all the time. And again, for this fight, I'm asking myself, can the sort of brawling-ish style of Amadovsky beat the multiple question marks around Hu Yaozhang? That's really what this fight is for me.
It is a really tricky one for Alan Amadovsky. Again, all of his 8 wins are by finish, all by KO or TKO. The Jocko fight, one judge had it 30-25, two of them had it 30-26, 12 on MMA decisions had it 30-25, 6 had it 30-26. Like, he just kept following and getting hit. And then if you look at it right now, he's been working in the States for the last couple of weeks at Extreme Couture. I'll pop the picture up there, but Gustafsson's in the corner. There's a lot of really big names there too. So if we have a look at the odds, Alan Amadovsky, I think I would say overwhelmingly opened as a favorite, minus 175. He's a minus 153 or thereabouts on best fight odds right now. For Hu Yaozhang, open a plus 130. He's a plus 125 or thereabouts. If we have a look at Topology, 1,288 total votes, 85% Amadovsky, 63% by knockout. For the 15% that have Hu Yaozhang, 52% by knockout. To me, there's too many question marks around Hu Yaozhang. I could say the same thing about Alan Amadovsky, and I mean that, because both of these guys, huge red flags. I mean, Amadovsky hasn't fought in quite a while. His last two fights were in Denmark, then in Russia, then with Bellator, it was Italy. Hu Yaozhang, this is his first fight in the States. First fight for both these guys in the States, too. So it's a really weird one. There's so many red flags. I'm going with Alan Amadovsky, but if Hu Yaozhang war on him, took him down, and beat the hell out of him, I wouldn't be surprised.
And I think that would be Yaozhang's best path to victory, but I do have to agree with you, and I do side with Amadovsky. There are so many question marks, not only around the coaching of Yaozhang, but also the travel, and really just a lot of confusion fight week, if we're being honest. So no, I do agree with your pick in Amadovsky.
Matt, really looking forward to this weekend's card. Both of us going with North Macedonia's own Alan Amadovsky to get the win. I can't wait for this card. This is the three-peat. This is the trilogy. Poirier taking on McGregor in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. The gig is up. The news is out. They finally found me. Jerome Rivera doesn't want to lose 4 in a row. And that's all I'm going to sing, Matt.
Wow.
This weekend, we have the renegade Jerome Rivera. He's taking on Zhao Gajumagulov. And if you're playing at home and you want a good Scrabble one, throw that tongue twister into the board. You're going to get a lot of points. And for Kazakhstan, Zhao Gajumagulov, this guy's been posted up at American Top Team for a little bit. I mean, I saw a picture on the IG when we were getting ready for Shavkat Rakhmonov's last fight against Michel Prezeris that he had Sergey Morozov and Zhao Gajumagulov. Now, it's a little bit different because for Rakhmonov, he was training over at Sanford MMA, and just down the road was Gumagulov. The last time I was there, I think it was, what, like 15 minutes, 20 minutes? You weren't there with me, but the gyms aren't very far apart. So
Sanford's got a new facility, though.
And that's true, but overall, we're talking about Florida. It's not that far away. So, you've got Zhao Gajumagulov, a guy who had tons of success before he came into the UFC, former Fight Nights Global flyweight champ. He had a big win over Ali Bagutinov, who, I mean, geez, the guy fought for the flyweight title in the UFC. For Jerome Rivera, we talked about it earlier with Hu Yaozhang. The guy started off in the UFC in a really tough weight class at heavyweight, then at light heavyweight, now at middleweight. For Jerome Rivera, 135, 125, 145. And the fight against Ode Osborne, it wasn't originally supposed to be at 45, but it was a short notice type of affair. And it's kind of funny because both guys have eyes at 125. Sure. But for Jerome Rivera, lose to Tyson Nam, lose to Francisco Figueiredo, and then lose his last time out against, again, a really tough out in the man himself, Ode Osborne. So we're trying to get it right. We're trying to go back down to 125. He lost to Francisco Figueiredo here. Does he have a good shot against Zhao Gajumagulov? Because the odds are definitely stacked against him.
Well, here's the thing. Because Zhao should be better than he is. Let's just be honest. Like, Chagas, we had pretty high hopes for when he came into the UFC. When you look at his body of work, at least before he came to the UFC, there's a pretty good fighter there. He's got a unique sense of striking. He's got decent cardio, but trust me, it's in question now. And there was a lot to like, I should say, about his overall body of work up until he did come to the UFC. But over his last two fights, I've been pretty disappointed. I know the Paiva fight was pretty close. It was a competitive fight, but he didn't look good against Albazi whatsoever. And it really depends on where you want to put Amir Albazi. If you do think he is like that next top tier contender or not, or if you just think, hey, he's a good prospect, but that's about it. But Chagas did not look good in that fight, and it was a weird fight because we talk about, and this fight should be kind of one of those clash of styles, to quote the great Mike Goldberg, but I look at Jerome Rivera, and the story, at least, of him coming into the UFC was that you gotta watch out. On the mat, he is tricky. If he's on top, if he's on bottom, it really doesn't matter. He's one of those guys who can get it done no matter what. And the weird thing about Rivera is that, if anything, he's been able to show that he's got decent cardio in the UFC. I know he gets stopped quick against Ode Osborne, but in the Figueiredo fight, you have to remember, he was the one putting it on Figueiredo at the end of that fight. I know he was getting out-grappled throughout the majority of it, but as that fight wore on, he does have decent cardio, and he is a guy who, if you don't get out of there early and if you don't finish him, he is just going to keep on wearing on you over and over and over again. And this will be an interesting fight because of the forward pressure of Jerome Rivera, along with the questionable power of Chagas. And I guess I'll let you talk a little bit more about this, because in my mind's eye, again, I think about Chagas as this really good one-punch knockout power. He can hit you with kicks, he can hit you with punches, but I don't really know if he has the type of power that can stop a guy like Jerome Rivera with just one shot.
With Zhumagulov, I would expect what he's worked on is to try and throw a little bit more volume, because he's very centered around single shots. It might be a hook, it might be a left cross if he's working from southpaw. That's the other thing. He can switch between the stances. Jerome Rivera, you're to see primarily out of southpaw, really long jab, really nice high kick. But for Jerome Rivera, he is at such an advantage in terms of height. He's 5'10 and he's gonna weigh 125 pounds. I'm 5'11. I couldn't worry. Like, I 125, I'm thin. 125 pounds. That's insane. So for Jerome Rivera, we'll see how the weight cut goes. He made it against Francisco Figueiredo and it worked out there. For both these guys, they have really high level fights. I mean, if you look at it for Rivera, he had that weird stumbling block, and you can go back into one of our videos to really kind of dive deep into Jerome Rivera's past, but he lost to Roberto Sanchez. That was Sanchez's ticket to the UFC. Then he lost to Brandon Royval, where he fell back and he got hurt. It was a really disgusting injury. He had to kind of build back up. He beats Luis Rodriguez in Contender Series 2020, then loses to Tyson Nam, because Tyson Nam is a buzzsaw for prospects. For Chagas Zhumagulov, like, he has a win over Tagir Ulanbekov, which just continues to look better from 2018, then the win over Bagutinov, and then he ends up, of course, in the UFC to lose to Halim Paiva in a close fight, and then to lose to Amir Albazi. So, again, you know that Zhumagulov is going to mix it up with the wrestling. He has so far in the UFC. 57% of the time he strikes. 42% he goes for a takedown. The other 1%, he just kind of screws off and lets his cardio kind of fall a little bit. For Jerome Rivera, he's been forced to strike the entire time, and he's lost every fight. So it is really tricky. It's going to be the pressure of Zhumagulov. We're going to see if there's going to be any kind of defensive shots from Rivera, if he's able to land something off his back. Tapology votes, 1,361 of them. 88% Zhumagulov, 82% by decision. For the 12% that have Rivera, let's make it fun, 54% by decision. Zhumagulov, the second biggest favorite on this card behind Sugar Sean O'Malley. Open to minus 400, he's minus 365 right now. For Rivera, open to plus 300, he's plus 277. So to answer all the questions, Matt, the fans have Zhumagulov, the odds have Zhumagulov. Both guys have been inconsistent in the UFC. One guy's lost three fights, one guy's lost two. I like Chagas Zhumagulov for the parts of his game. He's going to be at a huge height and reach disadvantage in this fight, but I still do like the forward pressure. If he's able to wrestle and stay on top and work his ground and pound.
Don't wrestle at all.
We saw him do before he came into the UFC. I like Zhumagulov in this fight.
For Chagas, why would you wrestle though? Like, you're the better striker. I know you're only going to be throwing single shots, but why mess around with the grappling at all of Rivera? I just don't think it would be worth it. For Zhumagulov, I think he can defend a lot of the takedowns from Rivera, and I do think he can keep this fight standing and just win rounds on the feet throughout this one. I do like Chagas in this fight.
It should be a very, very interesting one. I mean, from Jerome Rivera, we've seen 0% on his takedown accuracy, 0% that he's averaged, and 40% takedown defense. So it hasn't been good so far. Maybe this is the fight to right the ship. We've seen a lot of fighters recently on three-fight losing streaks able to buck that trend. I mean, Alessio Di Chirico is one that comes to mind, but it is a very interesting fight in an ever-changing flyweight division. I'm going with Kazakhstan, Chagas Zhumagulov. You're in agreement here. It is one hell of a fight card coming up this week, and you're not going to want to miss the rest of the video. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Couple of gritty vets going at it this weekend. In the middleweight division, we have the Wolverine Omari Akhmedov taking on Hawaii's Brad Tavares. And for Brad Tavares, he has spent the bulk of his career at Extreme Couture. And this is a guy that, believe it or not, has a win over Phil Baroni when they used to still name fight cards in the UFC. It was UFC 125 Resolution. That's crazy. I mean, I think of Phil Baroni as the guy that knocked out Dave Mene that one time, and the guy who ended up in a brawl at the end of Mark Coleman's Shogun Hua with Pride, but Brad Tavares beat him in the UFC, and now he's taking on the Wolverine Omari Akhmedov, who happens to be, 2 months older? Like, how crazy is that? It seems to me like it was only yesterday when Omari Akhmedov came into the UFC, and maybe his time for you has been entirely forgettable, but this is a guy that has a draw against a former title challenger in Marvin Vettori. He's 4-1 in his last five, his only loss there to a former champion in Chris Weidman. I mean, for Omari Akhmedov, he strikes to clinch, he clinches to get the takedown. He can work really good when he's on the ground, and that's what makes this fight so much fun. Because for Brad Tavares, he was on a 2-fight losing streak before his last fight where, I mean, did he have 1 foot out the door? Like, he just didn't look very good in those losses. But now they've kind of aged because of the names that he took on. And you look at the Brad Tavares that fought Antonio Carlos Jr. the last time he was out there. Like, holy frig, this guy's a world beater.
Yeah, he did. And he looked like he made a lot of improvements later on in his career, which is impressive, especially for a guy like Brad Tavares, which you mentioned. He's been around for a long time. And the wildest stat about Brad Tavares isn't just the fact that he fought Phil Baroni. He went almost 10 years between stoppage wins. I know you've got the stat, but he mainly wins by decision. And it's weird because you have two guys who normally when they do win, it is by decision. And that's what makes this fight so interesting. Because for Brad Tavares here, I guess you can get to the numbers, then I'll go.
Brad Tavares, most wins in middleweight history by decision at 11. That's tied for second most in the UFC. GSP, Diego Sanchez, and Neil Magny all have 12. The other one that I wanted to bring up really quickly, total cage time in the middleweight division. Michael Bisping, number one, 5 hours, 15 minutes, 15 seconds. Talis Laettes, number two, 4 hours, 23 minutes, 53 seconds. Brad Tavares, number three, he spent 4 hours, 8 minutes, and 5 seconds in the cage in the UFC. That's insane.
It really is. And he's been around fighting top guys for a really long time, too. It's not like Brad Tavares, he fights like once a year, and I guess that was the case for a few years there, but it is nice that Brad Tavares has been able to find a little bit of consistency, throughout the past couple years. But this is a really odd fight for Brad Tavares, and oddly enough, stylistically, this is a very favorable matchup for Brad Tavares, because when you just look at the bare bones game of Brad Tavares, well, what does he do really well? He can defend the takedowns, he's a good but not great striker, and I have to get some flack for this for saying this now, because I said this before the Antonio Carlos Jr. fight, and yeah, his striking looked better in that fight, don't get me wrong, but when Brad Tavares fights the Robert Whittakers of the world, I'll even throw like Derek Brunson in that category too. Like when he fights those upper echelon guys who have good power behind their shots, he does have to mix in his offensive wrestling a lot more. But when he's fighting wrestlers like Omari Akhmedov, he is really good at just defending a lot of the takedowns, forcing his opponent to work a lot, especially early on in the fight, and then bringing in his own game as the fight continues. And for Omari Akhmedov, it is kind of interesting. You look at his last loss, what happened in the Chris Weidman fight? He gets off to a really good start. He's able to grapple a little bit with Chris Weidman, and then exactly. Once that second round comes around, you're like, okay, Akhmedov held his own a little bit with the grappling with Weidman. I'm interested to see what these next 10 minutes will look like. It was one man very, very tired, and the other guy just consistently out-grappling him. Transition after transition after transition. And for Akhmedov, I do think he'll be able to get at least one takedown in this fight. Brad Tavares is a really hard guy to get down to the mat, but he's a really hard guy to keep down as well. And that's really what this fight's going to come down to. I think Akhmedov can go out there and get an offensive takedown on Brad Tavares. I don't doubt that for 1 second. But will he be able to hold Brad Tavares down? That's what it comes down to for me. And it's weird because Omari Akhmedov, oddly enough, has been able to hold down some really good grapplers, but other poor grapplers have been able to pop right back up to their feet. So this fight really does come down to how well can Brad Tavares get back up to the feet. And here's the other thing. I know who's going to win the third round if this fight comes to the third round. Without a doubt in my mind, Brad Tavares is going to win the third round if Akhmedov and him find their way to that third round. So for me, it is, can Akhmedov finish Brad Tavares? It's a really hard ask. Like, I know we get on Brad Tavares because he doesn't get a lot of finish wins, but it's a double-edged sword. He doesn't get finished a lot himself. He's a very defensively sound fighter, and even when he fought Adesanya, like, Adesanya basically picked him apart for 25 minutes, but he never went down once, and it wasn't even like he got wobbled. Like, he just got hit clean a lot, and maybe that's not a great thing, but still, he was a game guy throughout those 25 minutes, and for Omari Akhmedov, I know that he might be game for 5 minutes, and then after those 5 minutes, I've got a lot of question marks, so for me, I actually really like Brad Tavares in this fight.
It's a really close fight. If we look at it in terms of the numbers, both guys are kind of below average in terms of their output, but also what they receive in the octagon. Brad Tavares, a slightly crisper fighter. He also has better takedown defense, 79% compared to Akhmedov's 65%. Akhmedov, the guy that's better with the takedowns. He averages more takedowns. If you look at the odds for this fight, it's kind of weird because Brad Tavares open to minus 190. He's a minus 164 right now. Omari Akhmedov open to a plus 165. He's now at a plus 135 or thereabouts. And over on Tapology, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. 1,404 total votes. 66% Akhmedov, 82% by decision. The 34% that have Tavares, 77% by decision. So maybe if the over-under is set at either 1.5 or 2.5, you really like that because a lot of people think it's going to go to decision. Obviously, I told you, Brad Tavares is the decision king at middleweight. And if you look at it for Omari Akhmedov out of his last five, Tim Boach, decision. He beat Zach Cummins by decision. He beat Ian Heinisch by decision. He lost by decision to Chris Weidman. The Tom Breeze fight in his last one was back and forth in the first round. Breeze did a good job. Then at the end of the first round, he got a little busy off his back. Then in the second round, he kept wanting to get busy off his back. And then Omari Akhmedov suck in the choke. And the referee just kind of went, hey, Tom, you still there? Like, it was a weird stoppage. It really was. But it was a great win for Omari Akhmedov. And I don't discount any of his talents. I think both of these guys are very skilled. Omari Akhmedov is just pressure, 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 and he doesn't give up unless he gets tired. For Brad Tavares, he can work on the outside. He can strike in combination. He can throw some really good leg kicks, and he defends the takedowns very well.
Exactly. For all those reasons, I'm finding it really hard not to pick Brad Tavares. It is odd because you bring up the ages. Like, I think of Brad Tavares as being like 28 years old, even though he isn't anymore. And this is a really important fight for him. Like, are you a contender or not? That's been the question about Brad Tavares for about 10 years now. And I do think that this fight's really going to tell us which one he is.
Brad Tavares, contender, pretender, forever, number 14. For me, I've got Brad Tavares as well, going with the Hawaiian to get the win. I can't wait for this fight. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this middleweight showcase. Couple of guys that have popped in and out of the rankings. You let us know what you're thinking about fight name picks as well. Toss us a like and a sub if you don't mind. And Matt, we've got a big time card coming up with UFC 264. McGregor and Poirier in their third installment. You're not going to want to miss any of the other videos. Keep locked in with fight name picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
MMA math would say that Jennifer Maia is going to win this fight, but we can't play that game with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your host, you know, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen, FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials, at Matt Allen, FNP. And Matt, in this flyweight showcase, we have a couple of top-ranked women who've competed for the title, and Jennifer Maia and Evil Jessica Eye, or Jessica Evil Eye, that's what it is, for Jessica Eye. 2-3 in her last five. For Jennifer Maia, 3-2 in her last five. I lost to Joanne Calderwood, and Jennifer Maia beat Calderwood to get her shot at the belt. And then happened to win a round against the champion. Not something that happens very often. She's an elite company that way, I guess, with none other than Joanna Jane Jacek, if we want to play that game. But I look at this fight as a little bit of a clash of styles. Jessica Eye, she brings in the foundations that she was able to build at Strong Style while now working in Vegas, where she's been for the past number of years. And she strikes, and she strikes, and she strikes. And lately, she's been competing in some grappling tournaments. Maybe not winning as many as she'd like, but she has been at least trying to round out her game, especially at 34. She's a few weeks shy of her 35th birthday. For Jennifer Maia, coming in here at 32, representing Monstro MMA, and shoot the box. So for Maia, you get a little bit of the striking, but she definitely does a lot of her work on the ground when she has a lot of success, like she did against the champion in that title fight.
This is a really interesting fight and what should be an entertaining matchup. Now, for Jessica, I know I've been critical of her in the past, so I'm just going to sum up her game very simply. She has a very basic boxing style, although the commentary team is going to talk a lot about her boxing. They're going to say, you got to watch out for this woman's boxing. She's got combination. She's got power. Forget what they just told you. You don't need to remember that. She's a weird fighter in that they're going to talk a lot about her boxing, but offensively, she just tried to use her wrestling a lot, especially up against the cage. And I know we talked about the clinch a lot in her fight against Calderwood, and it was a weird fight because Jessica Eye goes into the fight saying, I know Calderwood's good in the clinch, but she's not gonna be ready for me. Proceeds to get lit up in the clinch multiple times by Joanne Calderwood and just keeps on getting in the same position over and over and over and over again. And listen, I know what the definition of insanity is. It's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And for Jessica Eye, that was what her game plan was. It was, I'm going to strike my way into the clinch. I'm going to strike my way into the clinch against the best clinch striker in the division. It was just a really weird game plan going into that fight.
Is that when you change your nickname from Evil to Insane? Or maybe like you go with like Vince Sanity?
She's going to have to switch something up. Because again, for you say no, she's lost two in a row and hasn't looked very good as of late. And the thing about Jessica Eye is that her game hasn't evolved that much since she was at Bantamweight. This is the thing about Jessica Eye. She even admits it. She goes, I knew my problem at Bantamweight was the weight. It wasn't my skill set. Not a thing I ever want to hear. And then when she went back down to 125, she was like, okay, now I'm fighting women who are my size. It's not going to be that big of an issue. I still remember Jessica Eye's first fight at the flyweight division. She fought a lady by the name of Kalindra Fahea, who is no longer in the UFC, did not have the best career. She head kicked Jessica Eye, hurt her in the first round, and probably beat her by decision. She ends up losing that fight. Jessica Eye wins by split decision, and then it sets her off on her kind of win streak that gets her to the title. For Jennifer Maia, I gotta be honest, I didn't really like her game up until she did fight for the title. And I shouldn't even say that. Going into the fight with Calderwood, I just had a lot of question marks. I understand Calderwood struggles with offensive heavy grapplers, but I still thought Calderwood's takedown defense would be enough to at least get her by in that fight. Immediately when that fight went to the mat, you could tell who the better grappler was. Like, Jennifer Maia really is that chick at this division. She is the Paul Craig of the women's flyweight division, if you will, where when you are on the mat, she is that submission threat that you do really have to worry for. And maybe I put a little bit too much stock into her beating Valentina for that one round. I can openly admit that. I change my opinion every day. But she did look terrible in that fight. She was one of the few women who left a Valentina Shevchenko fight and made Shevchenko at least look human. We didn't leave that fight thinking Shevchenko could still beat Amanda Nunes at 135. We left that fight thinking, hey, Shevchenko still has some more work to do, and we'll see what happens in the future. For me, though, I just look at Jennifer Maia as being the much more championship-ready fighter. When I still think of Jennifer Maia and her career moving forward, I still look at her in number one contender fights, in title fights moving forward, whereas with Jessica Eye, she's done a lot of big things in the sport, and she's been around in this division for a long time. I just think it's sort of time for the newer breed in Jennifer Maia.
It is a tricky fight, especially stylistically. Like you said, if Jessica Eye's closing the gap, is she able to pop, and then back out, or is she going to want to clinch like she did against Calderwood? And for Maia, it's weird. You look at it, you lose Caitlin Chookagian, and I know a lot of people, there might be some shine off of that one, but like, Caitlin Chookagian's a tricky fighter to beat. She really is, or she wouldn't be at the top of this division where she is. And then you lose to Liz Carmouche, and listen, I get it. Say what you will. Liz Carmouche looked pretty good against Watanabe in her last fight just a few weeks ago. And Carmouche is a game fighter who deserved to be in the UFC, and the way that they cut her was absolutely disgraceful. But if you look at it for Maia, former Invicta champ going back to 2017, a couple of wins over Roxanne Modafferi, big names coming up too. I mean, Sheila Gaff, Vanessa Porto, over with Bellator, Leslie Smith, Deanna Bennett as well. So if you do like Maia, there's a lot of parts and parcels to her game that you'd like to talk about. If you look at the odds for this one, Maia opened a minus 175. She's minus 195 right now. Jessica Eye opened somewhere around a plus 150. She's a plus 161 right now in best fight odds. And if we have a look at the total votes, not much of a surprise. 1,411 total votes on Tapology. 89% Maia, 80% by decision for the 11% that have Eye, 76% by decision. Maybe you like the decision prop in this one. I mean, Jessica Eye, of her losses, Calvillo by decision, Calderwood by decision, Shevchenko head kick was the last knockout. Maybe you like it to go that far, but I'm just going to stick with Jennifer Maia in this one. Again, we talk about a complete game. Maia definitely has that, as long as she can work on a little bit of her head movement and continue to improve on her cardio. I think Jennifer Maia will still be here to stay up the top of the division.
I couldn't sum it up any better myself.
All right, well, I certainly appreciate that. It was very nice of you. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this premier women's flyweight fight. Both of us going with Brazil's Jennifer Maia to get the win. I can't wait for this weekend's fights. UFC 264, Poirier, McGregor. In the co-main event, Matt, Gilbert Burns, Wonderboy Thompson. What's the secret of Wonder Boy's powers? We're going to find out. You're not going to want to miss those videos. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
What might be the funniest part of our next video is the fact that the guy on the left hand of the screen looks like he didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be a part of Picture Day. And yeah, that might happen in high school, middle school, elementary school, whatever school, vocational school, university. But for Ryan Hall, this guy is an absolute wizard at jiu-jitsu, and it just so happens to be his nickname. He works out of 50, spelled 50-50, the gym, and he teaches BJJ. And there is no whiz like this whiz. And if you look at it in his last few fights, he's been the favorite in his last three. You look at the level of competition. Darren Elkins, that was his last fight. It was a little bit ago, but in that fight, he showcased not just his grappling and his jiu-jitsu, but his striking as well. And it was really, really interesting to see kind of the evolution of Ryan Hall's game, a guy that's 36 coming into this fight. He's a southpaw, and he just offers a different look than what you normally find in this division.
Ryan Hall is why I know Brendan Schaub doesn't watch UFC. I just remember seeing a clip on Twitter, and he was like, Ryan Hall doesn't really throw kicks. But what? Ryan Hall throws a lot of kicks to the point where it's kind of wild. Ryan Hall dropped Darren Elkins with a spinning back kick. That's a thing that happened in a UFC fight. And for Ryan Hall, Shaquille O'Neal, whenever he wants to, like, be fancy and claim he's really smart, says, I have my G13 classification in X. And that just means he knows so much about one topic that that's the certification that you have. Ryan Hall has that in taking legs home with him. He is an absolute specialist, not only at jiu-jitsu, but really in leg locks. And it's wild. It might not mean a lot to beat a guy like BJ Penn after, let's say, like 2012. It means a lot to beat him by submission, though, okay? You might be able to knock him out in or outside of the cage. I don't mean that as a joke. BJ, get some help. But what Ryan Hall was able to do in that fight was so impressive. He went imanari roll into a heel hook, made BJ Penn turn the wrong way, and submitted him like it was no one's business. Again, we talk a lot about guys' records and resumes. It's not always how you beat a guy or who you beat. It is how you beat them. And when it comes to how you beat guys, Ryan Hall does it with style points.
Again, BJ Penn, for those of you who are behind the eight ball and you might shake and say, is BJ Penn a good fighter? And it comes up, no. Listen, this is one of the best fighters of all time. Again, before 2012, before he fought Rory McDonald, just before any of that happened. But the basis of his game was the fact that he could brawl. His jiu-jitsu was insane. And he was one of the lone Americans that made the change from, yeah, I'm going to train in the States, I'm going to train in Hawaii, to I'm going to Nova Uniao, and I'm going to train my jiu-jitsu with some of the best in the world in Brazil. For Ryan Hall to do what he did, even as old as BJ was, that was an absolutely insane win. And then to beat Darren Elkins the way that he did, and I mean, listen, yeah, again, he beats Gray Maynard. That was 4.5 years ago. He beat BJ Penn 2.5 years ago. Goodness. He beat Darren Elkins 1 year and 10 months ago. Okay, it's all good. We know exactly how good Ryan Hall is. And the craziest thing about Ryan Hall isn't the fact that he's taking on an uber prospect in El Matador, Ilia Topuria, representing Spain and Georgia. It's the fact that Ryan Hall lately has had marquee bookings that have fallen out. He was supposed to take on Ricardo Lamas twice last year. He was unable to do so. Once, it was the COVID card, or one of the COVID cards that fell apart. Then there was an injury. Then he's supposed to take on Dan Ige, Matt, in March. He's supposed to take on Dan Ige this year, and that fell apart. Dan Ige has had main events since. Like, it's crazy.
Ryan Hall's the definition of a fighter who can't get a fight with ranked fighters because he's so dangerous outside of the rankings. And it is unfortunate that he does have to drop to then fight a guy like Ilia Topuria, who, if you haven't been paying attention, is one of the hottest prospects in the UFC, really regardless of weight class. Because in Topuria, you don't just get great defensive grappling, great defensive wrestling. He's got all that in offense as well. And I'm not even going to bring up his boxing, which might even be the best part of his game. Because for Topuria, the one thing that I do have to say is the body work that he's able to do on the feet is really important. And it will be interesting to see, because he is a very, very aggressive fighter himself. So it'll be interesting to see how he approaches this fight. Because for me, I think this fight just comes down to game plan for Topuria. If he comes in with a smart game plan, he has more than enough skill to defend the takedowns of Ryan Hall, force Ryan Hall to become a striker, and then just make it one of those weird fights where it's like, okay, I'm beating him on the feet and he's going to pull guard a lot and maybe the fans won't like it, but Topuria should be able to win. Or will it be, I'll be really hesitant, I'm going to wait for Ryan Hall to come to me, and then if I'm the one defending the takedowns, if I'm the one on the receiving end of the grappling, then I'm a little bit worried about Topuria in this fight.
Ilia Topuria, if we know anything about him, really good wrestling to chain it into his grappling and his submissions. And for Ilia Topuria, you look at it, every single win but one by finish, and the one is against Yusuf Zalal in a fight where he looked great. He looked really, really good. That was his UFC debut. For Topuria, he is the former Cage Warriors Bantamweight champ. It was weird because he fought Breon Bulan and then took about a year off and he was with Brave. And I remember watching that Bulan fight, knowing how good Bulan could be, who's now fighting on like the prelims of the Cage Warriors cards, and saying, man, if this young guy can get a win there, he could be a star. He goes over, he beats Luis Gomez, he beats Steven Goncalves, then he beats Zalal, and then he beats Damon Jackson. And Damon Jackson isn't Ryan Hall, but Damon Jackson is really slippery on the ground. You saw that in his fight against Mirsad Bektic, where he looked amazing in that one. Well, he looked really bad until he looked amazing, but very, very good. Almost like a Derek Minner type of fighter, even though those are all kind of in the same weight class, division, Hilly so on Q. and so forth. But Ilya Topuria, really special fighter. So is Ryan Hall. If we look at the odds for this one, Topuria open a minus 220 favorite. He's a minus 239 right now. Ryan Hall open as a plus 185. He's a plus 190. If we have a look at the topology votes, incredibly close. 1,472 total votes. I said boats. I meant votes. So let's clear that one up. 55% Topuria. 60% of those fans have him to win by knockout. For the 45% that have Hall, 77% by submission. So the fans think that we're going to get a finish here. Ryan Hall's lone MMA loss to Eddie Fivey in his debut in 2006. He also lost to Saul Rogers of Bellator fame back in 2015 on the Ultimate Fighter Season 22. Then he beat Artem Lobov, the greatest of all time, who was 12-10-1 at the time in the Ultimate Fighter 22 finale to punch his ticket into the UFC. This fight to me is popping popcorn. I will ever so slightly side with Topuria, but I really agree with your analysis and the fact that if Ryan Hall's the first one to the jump, Ryan Hall can get a win here.
I'm kind of smart sometimes, Craig. I'd like to give myself credit. Here's the weird thing. I have so many question marks about this fight because for Topuria, and I'm going to bring up something you had mentioned before with Tom Breeze in the Omari Akhmedov fight. Topuria is a good grappler. Is he so confident in his grappling ability that he is okay with Ryan Hall shooting on him? Because this is my big problem. If Ryan Hall's the one shooting on Topuria, I don't doubt that Topuria can defend the takedown. He's not submitting Ryan Hall. There. Here's my guarantee this card. Topuria will not submit Ryan Hall. Now, it's probably going to happen, of course, but bear with me. I worry a little bit about Topuria's grappling because he is a good offensive grappler, but I do think his submission wins are a little bit deceiving. He is a guy who a lot of times will hurt his opponent with either ground and pound or hurt them with a big shot on the feet. And it's one of those like, okay, the easiest way out is I'm now going to submit you. I really do look at this more as a pure striker from Topuria versus pure grappling from Ryan Hall because I truly don't believe Ryan Hall can strike with Ilya Topuria, and I don't think Topuria can grapple with Hall, especially not for any extended grappling sequences. If you look at he almost tore BJ Penn's knee apart in 1 second. This is my issue. I like a lot about Topuria in this fight, and I do predict he's going to win. But again, if you do see Ryan Hall shooting on Topuria, he's going to be able to initiate a lot of those Damian Maia weird like half-guard sweeps and that. And that's why I do get a little bit nervous, and that's why I do say if you're Topuria, I wouldn't mess around with the wrestling whatsoever. Ryan Hall is one of those guys who, when I think of absolute monsters on the ground, like one shot, one kill jiu-jitsu, Ryan Hall's the guy who I think of. But again, I also side with Topuria. This is a really fun fight. Though
it is a great one, and listen, straight up, it just missed out on our fight of the night screen. This was the other one. We're both going with Georgia and Spain's Ilya Topuria to get the win. I can't wait for this fight. Let us know down below in the comment section who you're going with, and if you're listening on iTunes or Spotify, rate and review. You know, we never ask for
help
that,
the boys,
but we would appreciate it. Absolutely love the card coming up this weekend. UFC 264, McGregor and Poirier, the third installment. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. A fight I've had circled on my calendar since as long as I found out that it was official. We have South Africa's Dricus du Plessis taking on Trevin Giles. The mat for Trevin Giles. This guy's a police officer in Houston, and you look at the way that he fights, it's really interesting. Some fights, he can grapple a little bit. Most of the time, it's with his boxing, and you look at his last fight against Roman Delije. The guy had no fear, and he went in there with that power jab, just tossing the power jab, standing, planting, and throwing that left hand out there. But for Trevin Giles, he can bring his boxing into combination. Doesn't throw the most kicks. Maybe you'd like to see a little bit more out of him, but Trevin Giles, a very, very fun fighter coming out of a really neat gym in W4 Training Center. And he's taking on Dricus du Plessis, the former Cage Warriors champ. This is a guy that had absolute wars for as long as they lasted against Roberto Soldic. Comes into the UFC with a full head of steam. I sold tickets on him. And holy smokes, for the first 90 seconds of that fight, was I ever nervous.
It was just a really, really weird performance. And I know octagon jitters are something that we sometimes bring up, we sometimes don't, but they were apparent when Dricus du Plessis made his debut. It was just weird. He was in this, like, odd defensive shell almost in the first half of his fight against Marcus Perez. And listen, Perez isn't some world beater. Like, everyone had kind of expected du Plessis to win that fight. There was just sort of springboard in the UFC audience, and he did look good, but that performance does leave a lot of question marks, at least moving forward. Like, is that just an outlier of a performance? Did he just need that one under his belt, and now he will be good? The other thing I did worry about in that fight was he just doesn't deal with pressure all that well. And I'm not saying it was just in the Perez fight, but just he's a tall, rangy guy in this division, and he is someone who does like to use his kicks and his longer range combinations together, so But you do have guys like Trevin Giles who are going to try to close that distance on him a lot. It's going to be really interesting to see how Duplessis does to create distance in the cage. Because, like I said, he doesn't really have... He has good kicks, but he doesn't have, like, Tony Ferguson kicks where it's like, okay, I've got the front kick to really establish my range. I do think Duplessis is going to have to add some of those tools into his game because a lot of guys are just going to try to get as close to him as possible, close that distance. Because I would say if Duplessis has any significant weakness, and he is a very well-rounded mixed martial artist, I worry a little bit about his straight or his takedown defense against some of the upper echelon guys in the UFC. It's not that Trevin Giles is going to go out there and put the wrestling shoes on all of a sudden and wow, he looks like Chris Weidman, but Trevin Giles is a guy who offensively can mix in some takedowns. And this is what I don't like when you bring up the power jab of Trevin Giles. You're undervaluing his striking when you just bring that up because he's way more than just a power jab. He has great combinations and great hand speed. And I really do think his hand speed is the thing that makes him unique at this middleweight division because other than guys, and I'm going to bring up some really good fighters right now, but he does remind me of like a Robert Whittaker, which is the way he throws his combinations, a very loose way that he does throw. And that's what does concern me against a guy like Duplessis because in Duplessis, he's got good power himself. He's got great offensive submissions, and I'll be completely honest right now, Craig has a much better read on both of these fighters than I do, so I'm just gonna give you guys my notes on both, and then he could probably give you the better analysis on the two.
I like the Trevin Jones line and his stats so much, it's not even funny. And listen, with Fight Night Picks, we bring up little stats here and there, and it's more for fun, but when I go through this, 3.26 strikes per landed per minute is just below the UFC average. He absorbs 1.88. That's a great strike differential. 56% accuracy to 62% defense. That's really, really good, especially in the UFC. You can't look at Duplessis' numbers because he's had one fight and it was back and forth wildness, which is most of his fights. You look at Giles, though. Takedown average per 50 minutes, 1.37. His defense is 80%. His defense is 79%. His offense is 80%. Those are lovely little numbers. And when you look at it for a guy like Trevin Giles, it's not like he's fought, like, absolute scrubs, right? Like, again, his last fight, Roman Dolice, he beat Bavon Lewis, he beat James Krause in a close fight, I get it. Lose to Gerald Meerschaert, lose to Zach Cummins, that was kind of dirty. Loses by Gilly in both. Beat Antonio Braga Neto. Antonio, I'm calling you out. Where are you at? It seems like every time I talk about Trevin, I want to see more of Antonio. And he beat James Bokhnovic in his debut and knocked him out in 2017. Trevin has a really, really good line. He's also a long-rangey striker. Now, in this fight, he's going to give up a little bit of height. Reach, he's going to give up as well, but he does like to keep his head back, and he strikes quite well. So defensively, lends credence to how sound he is. Dricus Duplessis, a little bit more compact and in tight when he throws. He backs off a little bit on his kicks, so maybe if he fought a fighter who has really, really good head kicks, they can catch him when he backs up. It's going to be a really tough fight for Duplessis either way. And when I look at the odds, Matt, they're almost pick 'em odds. Duplessis opened an underdog plus 110. He's a minus 117 right now. Trevin Giles opened a minus 130. He's minus 106. And if we have a look at the total Tapology votes, maybe a little bit of a surprise. 1,348 total votes, 64% Duplessis, 48% by knockout, 16% by submission, 31% by decision. For the 36% that have Giles, 54% by decision, 36% by knockout. So there are a lot of people predicting a finish in this fight. Again, Duplessis, the former champ with EFC, welterweight, middleweight, former welterweight champ with KSW. A lot of quality fights on his record. Again, the two sold each fights. His first fight that he lost was to Gareth McLennan that was in the UFC. So Duplessis has taken on some good talent. And that Perez fight, did he just have to kind of weather the storm and realize, hey, I'm in the UFC? Because that one was in Fight Island. This one's going to be in the States. Dricus Duplessis, never fought in the States before, so that could be important. But for me, I do ever so slightly like Duplessis in this fight. Might be a little bit of bias there, so let that be cast aside, and I'm going to keep this one off my card, but I absolutely love this fight.
So this is actually going to be the first one we disagree on. I am ever so slightly going to pick Trevin Giles, because what Giles does is, he does have the counter for a lot of what Duplessis does well. Like, Duplessis does give up space sometimes. You know what Trevin Giles is really good at? Moving forward and throwing in combination, and the fact that Duplessis does leave with his head straight back does worry me when Giles does use his combinations, because when he is throwing 2, 3, 4 strikes in a row, that's when he is at his most dangerous. Look at the Bavon Lewis fight as a great example. So for me, I'm going to have her so slightly pick Giles.
Matt, I absolutely love this fight. We're split. I was going to say we're undecided, but we're split on the pick. I'm going with South Africa's Dricus Duplessis. You're going with Houston's own Trevin Giles to get the win. I can't wait for not just this fight, but the entire card. We got some big bangers at welterweight coming up that you're not going to want to miss out on. Carlos Condit's got a big time fight. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Matt, growing up here in Canada, due to the CRTC, we end up listening to a lot of Canadian content. And one of the songs that I really liked growing up by Red Ryder, before Tom Cochran kind of made them from Red Ryder to Tom Cochran and Red Ryder to just Tom Cochran, was Lunatic Fringe. And I think that song describes this fight perfectly. We have Florida Man, the hybrid Nico Price, taking on Brazil's Demolidor, Michel Pereira. And when I look at this fight, both of these guys are A, man bun champions at 170 pounds, absolute wild men, and both of them have 2 no contests on their record. How crazy is that? For Michel Pereira, this is a guy that came into the UFC with a lot of fanfare because he'd do moonsaults with Road FC and the other organizations he was with. He fought with Heat at one point, which is an organization that you should definitely look into if you haven't before, because they had, like, I don't know, big-time fighters and real oddities fighting with them. And if you look at it for Nico Price, and we talk about the no contest, well, he had one in his last fight, and he decided that sticky icky before a fight made a little bit of sense. It doesn't if you're a track and field runner, nor does it make sense if you're a fighter. And for Nico Price, he drew with Donald Cerrone. Now, would have won the fight if there wasn't an eye poke in the first round. One of the judges scored it 29-27 for Cerrone. The other two had it 28-28. Eventually, it's a no contest on the record. But for Nico Price, you look at it 2-2 with a 1-0 contest in his last 5 fights. For Michel Pereira, 3-2. The losses were kind of weird. He lost to Tristan Connolly, where he got too confident in Vancouver, and then he got tired. He lost to Diego Sanchez because he kneed him in the head. And Diego, I don't know if he got coached into it or what happened. I won't throw stones, as they say. But for Michel, he looked great in his next fight against Salim Imadiyev. He looked good against Chaos Williams in a back-and-forth close fight where you thought it was going to be fireworks, like I think this fight's going to be, but it didn't turn out so. But for Michel Pereira, he styled down the wildness a little bit in the Imadiyev fight and the Williams fight. For Nico Price, the guy continues to do his weird, funky thing. Coming out of Cape Coral, Florida.
Let's not put sugar over that Chaos Williams fight. That was an awful fight. It wasn't back and forth at all. It wasn't a good fight. It was just two guys who were well aware that their opponent had a lot of power, and they didn't really want to engage. And that's the weird thing about this fight, because for Pereira, that's kind of what your style is based around to begin with. Like, you are that 50-50 fighter who, yes, on your off day, you might be able to get grinded on the ground by a guy like Tristan Connolly, because, yes, you're not going to have great cardio. You might have some defensive lapses, but you're this offensive weapon that no one can really stand with. We're starting to see, like you mentioned, him tone down some of the craziness, but that was the thing that made him unique, and that's what I do worry about moving forward. The thing that makes Pereira is the fact that he can do the kicks, he can do the flips. The cardio is weird, and I know that's always kind of the commentary's gonna talk about it on his walk out to the cage. Oh, should he do the flip, should he not? It's gotten us talking about him more than just unranked welterweight X, so it has done its job, and this is the first real step-up competition that he's had in the UFC. Like, Nico Price is a legit, not contender, I think that's a little bit too far, but he's a legit action fighter in that, like, 25 to 15 range. I don't think he'll ever get a number next to his name, but I do know he can offer a very fun fight against guys who do have numbers next to their names. Go back, Randy Brown is a pretty good fighter, and he's the hotness right now. Nico Price knocked him out off of his back, doing hammer fist. Like, this is how unique of a fighter that Nico Price is, and how weird his power is. He's a guy who can knock you out with those weird short shots, kind of like how I always think about when Ngannou knocked out Cain Velasquez, where it was like Cain kind of went for the takedown, just that little tap, but it was enough to put him down. Nico Price has that kind of power, where it's like, wait, what landed? And then the replay shows it was like an up kick or some weird hook. Just a really fun fighter to watch. And the thing about Nico Price too, which is sort of an outlier, is he has great cardio for a guy who has really high levels of output. He can fade against upper levels. Like, go back to the Luque fight, for instance. He does get finished in the third round, really, in both of those fights. But when you just watch his fights, the eye test tells you that he can carry out very, very high output throughout 3 hard rounds. And that matters a lot. And that's honestly why Nico Price is at the stage that he is at. Like, again, Nico Price, we don't talk about this fight as a, okay, whoever wins this, you're ready for Neil Magny, or like Michael Chiesa next. No, but whoever wins this is then going to be put into a really, really fun fight. Maybe against like Santiago Ponzinibbio, or a name like that. Just guys out there who can offer really fun fights. I think this is a super fun fight on the card.
Winner of this fight gets Li Jingliang, and when great I look call. At this fight, for Michel Pereira, he is that tricky fighter. He trains out of a very weird gym in Vegas. Like, he's been in Vegas for some time, but it's not the extreme couture of the world. It's, what is it, Overcome Academy? For Nico Price, same goes to him. It's Syndicate Boxing in Florida. So, and he's been there for a long time, and I know that. But for Nico Price, the weird thing is, and it might have just been the judgment of his last fight, He's a big guy at 170. Fair. I know even against Cerrone, who's a smaller guy at welterweight, Nico Price is a big guy in his other fights as well. So I'll be interested to see these two guys face off. Maybe I'll save my judgment till then. I do have a hard time with it. The odds are relatively close. Michel Pereira opened a minus 175 favorite. He's a minus 165 right now. Nico Price came in a plus 150. He's a plus 134. If we have a look over on Tapology, the fans, 1,384 of them, 67% Pereira, 41% by decision, 50% by knockout. The 33% that have Price, 38% by decision, 50% by knockout. Half the people think we're going to get a knockout, Matt. What are you thinking? Who's
going to
win?
I think Nico Price is going to win. Now, it's going to be a very closely contested matchup, and I'm kind of surprised this isn't a pick'em fight, because this is one of those fights where either Pereira lands one massive shot and Nico Price goes down, or vice versa. I really don't think this is going to go to the judges' scorecards, but if it does, I actually like Nico Price in this fight for that reason. I know he's going to be there all 15 minutes really hard. I've seen him fight Vicente Luque twice, and yes, he got finished twice. He got knocked out and submitted, but they were two back-and-forth fights, and he gave just as much as he took, and I really do think that Nico Price, unless it is those top tier fighters, he's gonna be able to go out there and have a really entertaining fight. And this is what I talk about when I talk about fighters like Ciryl Gane. I'll throw myself under the bus when I bring up when Ciryl Gane fights that I've never seen him go through adversity. That matters to me, because for Pereira, he faced adversity against Tristan Connolly and basically gave up in that fight. And that's a question mark I'm really going to have moving forward. If the going gets tough, I do have that question mark around him. He completely changed my opinion of him in this fight. If Nico Price goes out there, drops him once, he gets up and knocks out Nico Price, then my opinion of him will completely change. But for this weekend, I still have to pick Nico Price.
I like Michel Pereira in this fight. Again, he's got 36 fights that have gone to, into his record, and two of them that ended up in no contest. So there's 38 pro fights. He's 27. Like, he's a Dominican 27 to me. Like, he's a Fausto Carmona type 27. I don't know about that one. It doesn't really pass the smell test. But when I look at this one, Michel Pereira is a dynamic fighter. I think he's going to bring a lot of different things to the cage against Nico Price. And Price is a guy that's dangerous everywhere. But if he's liable to do anything, I mean, out of his losses, how many losses are there by decision, Matt?
Not many.
No, exactly. I mean, there's only four of them, but listen, both these guys are wrecking machines. I'm going with Brazil's Michel Pereira.
It's going to be such a good fight.
In this fight, it should be a great one. You have Nico Price to get the win. I'm really looking forward to it. Big time one in our next one. Matt, Carlos Condit is fighting. It's must-see TV. You can't miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in the welterweight division. We have the former interim champ, the former title challenger, the former WEC welterweight champ, the natural born killer, Carlos Condit, on a tidy little two fight win streak, taking on another guy on a nice two fight win streak, and Max Payne Griffin coming out of Southern California, spends time at Team Alpha Male, among the other gyms that he frequents. And for Condit, he's been at Jackson Wink forever. And listen, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But with Carlos Condit, Matt, we've kind of seen a late career resurgence in other aspects of his game that he never seemed to accentuate.
Oh, so you're a grappler now. That's basically what Matt Brown was telling Carlos Condit during their last fight. Because the story going into that was, okay, Matt Brown, Carlos Condit, two great warriors, very old in their career, going to be a great stand-up fight. Carlos Condit said, that's cute and all, but I'm going to show you all these new tools that I've been working on. And it was really nice to see, honestly, because Carlos Condit's big Achilles heel throughout his career has been the wrestling defense. It's been, if you can get him on his back, you can hold him there. But we did see, at least against Matt Brown, a different version of Carlos Condit. One that wasn't afraid to go for sweeps. He was a little bit more committed to the submissions when he was trying to threaten with them. And overall, it was just a really good, well-rounded performance from Carlos Condit. And it was something that you had brought up earlier, where it's not just the fact that he beat Court McGee and Matt Brown. Yes, those names in a vacuum might not look very good, but it's not like Court McGee's completely washed. And same thing with Matt Brown. Like, those guys are still out there putting on decent performances. So the fact that Carlos Condit, who I gotta be honest, even I thought was completely washed, is still out there putting on really competitive performances, it's just a really nice thing to see.
If you like this fight, all you have to do is toss a like up there. It takes 2 seconds. I mean, I like this fight, but it can't like my own videos, you know? That's how it works. But when I look at this one for Max Griffin, the last two wins, wow. I mean, you look at the fights before the wins. I think that's the most telling part. So go back five. Majority decision over Zalim Imadaev. Well, we talked about Zalim Imadaev. He fought Michel Pereira. He looked bad. Zalim Imadaev, they sold you Wolf tickets. He was in that Hadis Ibrahimov Russian category of not so great. Then he loses to Alex Morono. That was a back-and-forth war. That was a great fight. Then he loses to Alex Oliveira by split decision. That was another back-and-forth fight. It was enjoyable. He goes to fight Ramiz Brahimi, and he goes in there just whipping elbows. It popped Ramiz's ear off. That was kind of gross, but a great win for Max Griffin. And he really withstood some adversity in that fight to get the win. Then his last time out against Sung Kanan, I remember getting ready for that fight just 4 months ago, being like, yeah, you know, it's a close fight on paper. I don't think Sung Kanan's really fought the same level of talent. I think Max Griffin's going to win this fight. But I didn't think he was going to win the fight like that. Like, he looked amazing.
He really did. And for Max Griffin, his game is kind of basic. Like, nothing he does really jumps out of the page at you. Like, he's a good boxer. He's got good wrestling. But again, it's not like he's some Yair Rodriguez type striker who you watch and you're like, wow, I need to see a lot more of that. Like, he's got good but not great power, I'd say. The one thing I will say about Max Griffin, though, he's leveled something up that isn't like an intangible, like kickboxing. He's leveled up his mentality. He does have more of a killer instinct now, especially his last two fights, than he was showing. Because it was weird. Max Griffin went from being that all-action kind of fighter who was on the prelims, got a little bit of notoriety, and it almost felt like he kind of went away from that fighting style. But then it was like, okay, I'm gonna get my mind right, if that's the proper way of saying it, and I'm gonna go back to fighting in the style that he once was fighting at when he was making his way up the rankings. And listen, take out the Colby Covington loss, I guess, at UFC 202, he was on a really good run. And this is a weird fight, because most of the time we do talk about Carlos Condit versus his opponent. It's how much older is Carlos Condit than his opponent. But this is going to be one of those weird fights where it's like, oh, not that much. He's 37, but Max Griffin is 35. And this is always the weird thing when I talk about Max Griffin. I always think he's like 31, 32, but he is a little bit more advanced in his age. So if he is expecting to go on some kind of a run, this has got to be it. Like, you've got to go out there against Carlos Condit and really prove a point. Because you're never going to get another opportunity like this where it's as big of a name as Carlos Condit at this sort of weird limbo of his career. Because one thing I think we can all agree on, myself included, is that Carlos Condit now isn't as good as the Carlos Condit who fought GSP. I don't think that's it's not a bad thing to say. It's you're 37, you're gonna age.
You had 45 pro fights.
Exactly, and all against like top level guys for the most part. The question is, has Carlos Condit's striking diminished to the point where Max Griffin could go out there and outstrike Carlos Condit? Because for me, I think Max Griffin's the better wrestler, but I do wonder if he can just go out there and hold Carlos Condit down, like we've seen some guys in the past do. Because listen, it's one thing for a guy like Neil Magny to do that, who maybe his wrestling is only a little bit better than Max Griffin's, but his cardio is so much better that he can just really be dedicated to the takedown over and over again. For me, I actually think this is an oddly winnable fight for Carlos Condit, and I'm almost kicking myself in the back, because last time I had one of those, like, oh, I used to be a big fan of this guy, and now I have to not be biased, it was Matt Brown, and I said he was going to lose to Diego Lima, and what did Matt Brown do? He went out there and was able to turn back the clock one last time, and even to throw in another, like, basketball reference, Brook Lopez recently, who, like, a lot of people thought was over the hill, the Lakers didn't even want him on the team, in one game in the playoffs, went back and scored his career high and got 33. I think Carlos Condit still has enough tread on the tires to have at least a really fun competitive fight with Max Griffin. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I do think Carlos Condit can even win a unanimous decision against Griffin.
Condit the underdog. He opened a plus 150. He's a plus 155 right now for Max Griffin. Open a minus 175. He's a minus 190 right now. I know those sound wonky, but those are the averages at best fight odds. In terms of the Tapology votes, 1,350 of them. They're surprises to us as they are to you. 57% Griffin, 43% Condit. 75% of them have Griffin to win by decision. 78% have Condit to win by decision. The weird thing is, Carlos Condit, the large majority of his wins are by finish. I know we talk about it, and we talked about it into his last fight, the fact that he has so many submission wins, but he's usually, if the striking kind of gets him into a submission, then we're going to go for it that way. But his last two fights, we've seen him really accentuate his wrestling. And it was weird because you would have thought Court McGee would have been offensive with his wrestling, but he wasn't. And the striking kind of opened up for Condit. And then in his last fight, really did well with the wrestling. For Max Griffin, his striking continues to get better. He does have the wrestling to fall back on. But Griffin was always one of those guys that needed to kind of get hit to get into a fight. So we'll see how that plays out in this one. I do like Max Griffin in terms of more tread on the tires. And he hasn't had those absolute wars. He's had wars, yes, but he hasn't had 45 pro fights. He's at 25. So I'm going to go with Max Griffin in this one ever so slightly, but I do love this fight.
Oh, without a doubt. And for Griffin, I really think his boxing is going to be how his bread gets buttered. He's really going to have to get on the inside of the range of Carlos Condit. But that's the thing. Condit has the much more wide variety of strikes in his toolbox. He goes for flying knees. He does through the elbows. He has a lot of weird, unique things that I do think could cut up the face of Max Griffin and at least make a lasting impression on the judges. And for that reason, I've got to say Carlos Condit at the age of 37 is still maybe going to win a UFC fight.
Maybe. Matt's got Condit, I've got Griffin. Absolutely love the fight. Let us know down below who you've got in this one. Are you going with Payne, or are you going with the natural born killer? Maybe it's a draw. You go with the painful natural born killer. I don't know, but it's a great fight. We've got some more great ones coming up that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Main card of UFC 264 as it's set right now. We have Sugar Sean O'Malley taking on a late replacement in Milford, Massachusetts' own Chris Moutinho. And Matt, when I look at this fight, it's a really interesting one. It was originally supposed to be Luis Smolka and O'Malley. Smolka out due to a staph infection. So in on just over a week's notice, we have a guy coming out of a big gym, I would say, in Regiment Training Center's own Chris Moutinho. And I say that because, I mean, one of his head coaches, Jorge Rivera, a guy who beefed with Michael Bisping. Did Bisping spit on him in his corner?
Yeah.
Maybe, and he probably shouldn't have done that. But now Rivera has coached the fighter representing New England here. And while the record might not be all that sexy at 9-4, I look more so at the losses and the quality of opponent on the record. You look at it for Moutinho, and he has a win over Damon Blackshear, a guy who really has been there and done some things. He also has quality fights against Tony Gravely and Johnny Campbell, his last two losses. Now, are they the greatest of loss? Well, Tony Gravely beat him in the championship rounds. And listen, that's just going to happen. And Johnny Campbell finished him. But Johnny Campbell also beat Henry Corrales in his last fight. Maybe not the greatest record from Johnny Campbell, but that win means something. For Chris, he picked up really big wins 8 months ago against Ashiq Ajim with CES, who was 3-0 at the time, finished him. Finished Andrew Salas, who was 6-5 at the time, just a month and a day ago. And if you go back and watch that fight, man, it is a lot of fun. They strike back and forth, and Moutinho puts it on Salas. But Salas was like a Justin Gaethje, Homer Simpson, where he just continued to eat the damage until he got him to the mat. He submits him. Very big win. Punching his ticket to the UFC on incredibly short notice. And this is a guy that I've seen train in the past, or I've seen on the Instagrams with a Mitch Raposo, who you might know from The Ultimate Fighter. I haven't been following the show, but I just know that much, and I know who Mitch is. So a lot of really good connections. I think this should be an interesting fight. And credit to Chris Moutinho. He's going to wear UFC trunks and make a walk to the octagon, something you and I will never, you might, but I definitely won't. So do you think you will?
No, and that's fine. But this is my big problem with this fight. People like to look at the UFC and say it's not like boxing at all. It's nothing like boxing. It's nothing like boxing. Why is Sean O'Malley not fighting Ricky Simone? Why is he not fighting Brian Kelleher? Why is he not fighting Cody Stamann? There's a lot of guys in this division and in featherweight, anywhere between 135 to 145 pounds, basically, who have all raised their hands saying, hey, give me 5 days and I will fight Sean O'Malley. But the UFC said, nope, that's well and dandy. We want this guy fighting a guy. And this is no discredit to Chris, but you're not Ricky Simone. Like, the reason Sean O'Malley isn't fighting one of those guys is because they don't want him to lose. And listen, I don't think it's Sean O'Malley is the one who doesn't want to fight those guys. I'm sure if it was up to O'Malley, he would fight Simone. He would fight Kelleher. But the UFC sees a potential star in him. And sometimes you have to protect the fighter from themselves. That's why people say they want judges or refs to throw in the corner or to throw in the towel and have an early stoppage better than a late stoppage. Because if you let it be up to the fighter, Sean O'Malley would fight Piotr Jan tomorrow if he could, I'm sure. But again, the UFC sees dollar signs with him, and the more he wins, and the more that they can put cameras in front of his face and microphones in front of his face, the more money the UFC is going to generate because of Sean O'Malley. I'm just going to leave it at this. Sean O'Malley's going to win this fight because the UFC wants him to win this fight.
See, that's always tricky, but if I look at it for Chris Moutinho, well-rounded, he can do good work on the ground, but primarily a striker. The only trouble is, and he can land great in combination. He throws nice front kicks. He throws nice leg kicks. He might just be a step slow against Sean O'Malley, who can also incorporate the grappling if he really does need to. I know you might not see as many submission wins on O'Malley's record as there are knockouts, but you know that that's the thing that he's working on so much with Tim Welch. I'd really like to see it in a fight, but maybe this isn't the one that you try and showcase it. If you want to see a disgusting knockout, go to Sean O'Malley's last fight when he fought Thomas Almeida on a full camp and just beat him pillar to post.
You had high hopes for Almeida.
The poor old referee, one of 11 herbs and spices, decided that we needed one extra shot. Well, bam! So in this fight, I look at the odds, Matt. O'Malley opened a minus 500 favorite. He's a minus 822 right now. For Chris Moutinho, opened a plus 375. He's a plus 536. I'm sure the Tapology votes aren't close. Boom goes the dynamite. 906 total votes. 96% O'Malley. 91% by knockout. For the 4% that I have Moutinho, what is it? 58% by knockout. I have Sean O'Malley in this fight. I apologize if it's not the longest or busiest one of our videos. But if you do want to go out there and watch some Chris Moutinho fights, I definitely encourage you to, because it's a lot of fun to watch his regional scene fights. I know I enjoyed it against some quality opponents. Again, Gravely's one of those guys that's going to take you down and wear on you. We saw that against Draco Rodriguez when he fought with King of the Cage. That's just another name of a prospect that came into the UFC that had that Gravely experience. Johnny Campbell, another one of those vets of the game. I think he was 17 and 12 when they fought. You're not going to beat those guys sometimes, but the O'Malley fight is very difficult. And if you feel strongly, or you know that Chris Moutinho has got something up his sleeve,
then you're related to him.
Or you're Jorge Rivera, but you let us know down below in the comments section. I've got the wacky hair and wild stylings of Sean O'Malley. Matt, you got O'Malley.
I'll put this out here, though. Chris, if you're watching this video and you need motivation, these two guys still think you can win. If you want to go out there and prove us wrong, beat Sean O'Malley. Because if you beat Sean O'Malley,
you're on the show.
Everything changes when you beat a guy like Sean O'Malley. Marlon Vera started getting beer sponsorships out of nowhere. Like, it changed Marlon Vera's career trajectory from just being a fun fighter to being, like, a guy who people really consider when they think about the bantamweight division. Beating Sean O'Malley isn't red panty night a la Conor McGregor, but it's a big deal in your career. So Moutinho could go in there and prove us wrong, then good on him.
Go out there just like Terrence McKinney did a couple of weeks ago. Exactly. Pull one of those wins out, but Matt, unfortunately, for Chris Moutinho, we're both going with Sean O'Malley this weekend. Like I said, let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this one. And if there's a shot for Milford's own, Matt, we've got a big time card coming up on this main card. Heavyweights brawling. You got a co-main event that you're not going to want to miss. And in the main, it's the third leg of the trilogy. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend. Women's bantamweight action. We have Irene Aldana taking on Iana Kunitskaya. And Matt, for Iana Kunitskaya, it's a nice little win streak coming into this one. She's 4-1 in her last five. She's won her last two fights going back to last year. One over Yulia Stoyarenko in just a really weird fight. And then one over Ketlin Vieira in just a weird fight. Both these women having wins over the Brazilian Vieira. If you look at it for Irene Aldana, again, 3-2 in her last five. We now have our first Mexican champion in the UFC in Brandon Moreno. But for a lot of people, they assumed, and well, wrongly, that Irene Aldana would be the first Mexican champ, especially after she beat Ketlin Vieira and knocked her out so quick about a year and a half ago, or a little bit over that. But her last time out was 8 months ago. She fought Holly Holm. She kind of got beat pillar to post. It was like a y'all must have forgot for Holly Holm in that fight.
Yeah, Renee Aldana just didn't look great in that performance. And it's weird because I'm going to throw another name who was known for a really big highlight. That's kind of what they're known for. Look at Joaquin Buckley, for instance. He has a weird career, a couple fights, and then, okay, wow, you're known for this great knockout. That's what people know you for. You're expected to kind of replicate that or do something similar every single time you go out there. And for Joaquin Buckley, listen, he had that great win over Jordan Wright and then that really bad loss to DiCirico. So we don't really know what we're going to get. But for Irene Aldana, it's weird. You kind of have her whole career. Then she has this massive posterization, if you will, that beautiful knockout over Ketlin Vieira. And then people really start believing in her to the point where it's like, hey, you should fight Amanda Nunes next. And I'm pretty quick to buy into hype. I can openly admit that. But even I was like, hey, guys, the Irene Aldana hype is a little bit too high. And I remember saying going into that Holly Holm fight, like, hey, I know we're all excited about her boxing, but now she's fighting someone who that's like what she does. That's all she does is kickbox and box. And what we saw in that fight was that, okay, when Irene Aldana does fight the upper echelon strikers, I'm going to throw Jermaine Durandamy in there as well. I don't, the matchup hasn't been made yet, but just stylistically, we can assume. For Aldana, she does struggle against people who throw straight shots down the middle, who can beat her to the punch, and she does struggle against the takedown. That's the one thing that I never really expected out of Aldana. Like, she does have really good forward pressure, she has great volume herself, but when you do look at yourself as one of those top-tier boxers, then fine, you can get out wrestling. But the fact that in that Holly Holm fight, she got outstruck by Holly Holm and out-grappled by Holly Holm, it just really hurt her stock in my eyes, and this was someone who didn't have a lot of stock in her to begin with. You had a massive opportunity against Holly Holm, who was a fighter kind of, is she on the back nine of her career? She's on, I don't know, weird waters, to say the
putting
least.
Putting green.
Yeah, okay, yeah, she's on the putting green. No one really knows what hole she's on, but Holly Holm is definitely at the later end of her career. And a lot of people felt like that fight was going to be this massive springboard for Aldana. You have the younger striker up against sort of, I guess, Aldana 1.0, if you will, or at least that's how the fight was being billed. But you saw Holly Holm, like you had said, y'all must have forgot, went out there and just kept on beating Irene Aldana to the punch. And that was the thing. Aldana could never get her combinations going because she could never get her jab going. And with Aldana, everything relies on, okay, I'm going to go jab, right, and then hook, or jab, and then set up my other attacks from that. She's a fighter who does need to get going downhill, kind of like Tim Means, but the problem is she kind of needs the jab before she can go downhill. And against someone like Kuniskaya, who, listen, I can't go out there and tell you that Kuniskaya is great with her kicks, she's great with her punches, but she is very well-rounded, and she is a fighter who's not afraid to go into the clinch. She's not afraid to go for the takedown. She knows that she's well-rounded, and she can really weaponize that to great effect. And that's the really cool thing about Yana Kunitskaya, sorry, that's been the really cool thing about her career projection. Because for Kunitskaya, we knew her as, okay, you were the lamb being slaughtered against Chris Cyborg.
You just kept fighting Tonya Evinger before that?
Exactly. So you fight Tonya Evinger for what seems like 3 years, and then you fight Chris Cyborg, who we all kind of knew what was going to happen in that fight, but she kind of she took her back, and a lot of people were excited. Then she went on a really nice streak. With Arena, I keep on mixing their names up. With Yana Kuniskaya, I really feel like we kind of know her ceiling. We know that against a wrestler, she's going to be able to keep the fight on the feet, and against a striker, she's going to go for the takedown. With Irene Aldana, she's just going to keep on striking, and that's what worries me in this fight. Can just her striking get her by the multifaceted attack of Yana Kuniskaya? I don't really know, and that's what makes this fight so fun.
It's tricky, too, with Irene Aldana, because we've never really seen her takedown defense tested so much by these contenders, because Raquel Pennington was able to get a takedown. And I'm looking at the numbers, that's it. Until the Holly Holm fight. Holm went 5 of 14, and if you look at the total number, 84% takedown defense for Aldana. It might come as a surprise if you're really trying to knock her takedown defense. And for Yana Kunitskaya, you're right. She can mix it up. She's positive in terms of her strike differential, in terms of her takedowns. She's a little bit more active with the takedowns. And we did see, again, a really weird fighter last time out there against Ketlin Vieira. The tried and true telling method of this fight, Irene Aldana has a negative strike differential. She lands 5.52 significant strikes per minute. She absorbs 5.97. Yana Kuniskaya, 4.22 to 2.62. Better numbers. And with Aldana, it's at a lower percentage in terms of accuracy. 38% to Kunitskaya's 57%. Again, she is so good at pawing that jab that a lot of those are going to miss, or they're going to hit the guard. And it's always tricky to tell what actually scores and what doesn't. But when you're busy like that, it will tend to score with the judges. Like, it's hard not to agree that
Marina Barros went on quite a streak just doing it.
And the other thing with Irene Aldana, if you look at it for her overall body of work, two fight of the nights, one in her debut against Leslie Smith, one against Lucia Pudzilova, performance of the night bonus when she did end up fighting Ketlin Vieira to get that win. For Yana Kunitskaya, no bonuses so far in the UFC, but again, a former Invicta champ in this one. So it is a tricky fight if you're trying to figure out who's going to win this one. So for me, I do keep it off my card, but the odds have me intrigued. Aldana opened to -125. She's a -119 favorite. Kunitskaya opened to +105. She's a -104 right now. A slight underdog. If you have a look over on Topology, 1,378 total votes. 59% Aldana with 82% having her to win by decision. For Kunitskaya, 41% of the overall vote, 89% for her to win by decision. I would probably take the over in this one. If I made that the official pick, that might even end up on the Fight Night Picks Kick Parlay if I didn't retire it last weekend. So I guess stay tuned for that one on Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims. But I have a hard time with this one, Matt. What are you thinking?
Personally, I do like Yana Kuniskaya. We've seen Irene Aldana. If you do just strike with her, you can beat her. And that's the thing she's supposed to be great at. Like, even go back to her UFC debut against Leslie Smith. And listen, Leslie Smith is a really good fighter. But when I think of Irene Aldana currently, it's a lot of what I think about with Leslie Smith. It's just a high-volume, boxing-heavy fighter. But the problem is Aldana did show that the takedown is such a problem, especially against a fighter like Holly Holm. I think Holly Holm is an okay grappler. She definitely showed that against Megan Anderson. But I know Yana Kuniskaya is at least a good grappler. And she has one of the best, I guess, life training partners in Thiago Santos going. So I guess not for that reason, but for many others. I do like Yana Kuniskaya in this fight.
I like the well-roundedness of Kuniskaya as well. And as a decent little underdog and the line keeps moving, I've got Kuniskaya here. Let us know down below in the comments section. You going with Russia's own or Mexico's own? For us, we're going with Kuniskaya in this one. I absolutely love this main card, Matt. There's three big fights left. Hardy's taking on Tuivasa. Then you have Burns and Wonder Boy. And then in the main event, the third installment of the trilogy, you're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Matt, coming up this weekend, UFC 264, we've got a pair of some of the biggest heavyweights you're going to find in the Prince of War. Greg Hardy's taking on Bam Bam Tai Tuivasa. And for Australia's own Tuivasa, he was on a not-so-good losing streak. It seemed like he was out of the UFC by his own volition, only to end up in a fight with Stefan Struve, where he not only saved his career, but really kind of ended Stefan Struve's MMA career, not just UFC career, because he knocked him out once, jumped on the cage, tapped his ankle on Struve's head and knocked him out again. Or that's what it looked like to me. Maybe you'd have to watch the replay a few times, just like Bozer's knuckle in the fence. But it wasn't, see? Now, for Tai Tuivasa, he looked great in his last fight, but it wasn't the fight he was supposed to have. He ended up taking on Harry Hunsucker, and if you knew anything about Harry, he could knock out guys on the regional scene in the Midwest, but not Tai Tuivasa. Tuivasa looked great in that one, but that was almost to be expected against a guy that, I mean, no disrespect, Harry, you could knock me out 10 times over, and I'd just pop right back up like a Weeble Wobble.
He's probably a better salesman than you are, though, Harry, so there's a give and take to both of this.
But in that fight, Harry Hunsucker, just, he was a sacrificial lamb in that fight. For Greg Hardy, he took on much stiffer competition his last time out, Marcin Tybura. The first round, not the most competitive. The second round, he got finished. And for Greg Hardy, he looked not only bad, but human in that fight. Like, it was a weird one.
It really was. And for Greg Hardy, listen, people aren't going to give a fair, just, I guess, critique on his career, no matter what. It's just, I'm not even going to get into it, but it's really hard to give a good opinion on what his career has been. But he has been a fighter who's made improvements. And it was really interesting because he seems like he's getting better. He makes, you know, he stumbles out of the gate. There's the whole puffer thing. People don't like him anyways. And then you finally seem to improve enough to where, okay, you're ready for a contender. Now, at that time, Marcin Tybura wasn't the Marcin Tybura we know right now. He was okay, but he definitely didn't have the wins under his belt that he has right now, and he wasn't on the streak that he's on right now. Greg Hardy started that fight out looking really good, defended a few takedown attempts, was lighting Marcin Tybura up on the feet, and then he hit a wall. And it's weird because Greg Hardy has hit this wall in every single one of his fights. He had never fought anyone good enough to really capitalize on it. Where Greg Hardy is one of those fighters who, he's got that great first round. He can explode in that first round. But then his output does start to really fall off a cliff. And the weird thing about Greg Hardy is that I don't even know if it has to do with his cardio as much as just his output in a lot of his fights. Because if you look at his fights, it's been both ways, but the majority of the time, he'll win that first round, he can sort of win the second round, and then he holds on long enough to win that third round. And against a guy like Tai Tuivasa, Tai Tuivasa is at least going to bring a few hurdles that you're going to have to get over. Tai Tuivasa throws the calf kick very, very well. We saw the last guy do that to Greg Hardy, have great success with it, and Jorge de Castro. And really, Jorge de Castro fights a lot like Tai Tuivasa. He just doesn't have the size, or I guess Tai Tuivasa's technique is a little bit better than Jorge de Castro's, because I would say even you would have to agree with this, because there hasn't been a bigger naysayer of Tai Tuivasa than the man sitting to my right now. But he's gotten better in his last two fights. Like, he was a guy who I never really felt like evolved throughout the early part of his career, but I would say throughout the last two performances, he has shown minor improvements at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it for Tuivasa, it was definitely like, I'm a good fighter. Now I'm losing. What do I do? I'm starting to kind of gain water, tread water. And then he was stunting against Junior Dos Santos. That was a really weird fight. And listen, he fought Junior Dos Santos, and I get it. Like, the guy that fought Rozenstruik, the guy that fought anybody up the top, Ciryl Gane, he was really having a rough time in his career. But in that Tuivasa fight, he still had it a little bit within him. He still had the speed, he still had the power, and he looked great in that one. And Tuivasa definitely didn't. And again, if you go back through, let's talk the last five, the losing streak. JDS, Blagoy Ivanov, Sergey Spivak, those are all really good fighters. For Greg Hardy, you had the fight against Ben Sassoli. Alexander Volkov he loses to. Jorgen De Castro, Maurice Green, and then Marcin Tybura. So you come into a fight like this, a big step up for Hardy, even though, again, he fought the fight of, well, Marcin Tybura's life. Like, I bet you Marcin was in the background listening to that duet with Joe Cocker, like, love lift us up where we belong. And he just went in there and put down his game plan, just like he watched Sergey Spivak do to Tai Tuivasa. So great win for Tybura, but when I focus in on this one, what improvements has Hardy made? Is his conditioning any better? Because again, this was a fast twitch lineman in the NFL. Now you're going for the long game in MMA, and it's totally different than those quick bursts about over and over and over again. You can't have the old performance enhancing puffer, and there's a lot of differences. And obviously he's realized that. He's almost 33 years old. You get a little bit more leeway when you're a heavyweight, but right now at 7-3 with 1-0 contest, this guy came into the UFC undefeated. So it's a really tricky fight for him. For Tuivasa, two-fight win streak. And when I look at the odds, Matt, Tuivasa open a minus 170 favorite. He's a minus 139 right now. Greg Hardy open a plus 145. He's a plus 114. And for the total Tapology votes, surprise to us as it is to you. Wow. 1,497 total votes, 75% Tuivasa, 82% by knockout for the 25% that have Hardy, 60% by knockout. I think we're going to get a finish in this one as well. So if there was an under 2.5, I'd go with it. If it's at 1.5, which I suspect it will be at, I'm going to have a hard time with that one. But what are you thinking in terms of the X's and O's as to who's going to win here?
Jordan Castro is beating Greg Hardy by basically being slightly faster with his footwork, having better leg kicks, and then just having, and I'm not even saying good volume, having slightly better volume than Greg Hardy. He was well on his way to winning at 30-27 in that fight before he did break his foot and just completely abandoned the leg kicks. I don't think Tai Tuivasa is going to have that same problem. I don't really think the bones in his feet are going to give way. And if I can somehow predict that, then I'm some kind of a clairvoyant, which I obviously am not. But I do like the overall game of Tai Tuivasa. Like I said, we've seen Greg Hardy struggle with guys who do the things very similar to Tai Tuivasa. I do think the leg kick should be a big, big weapon for Tai. And I do think the overhands eventually will land on a guy like Greg Hardy. Should be an interesting fight. I do think we're going to learn a lot about both guys either way. But I do have to side with Tai Tuivasa.
I'm on a fence. I like Tuivasa to outlast Hardy. And if it goes up against the fence, if there's any clinch work, I like the uppercuts from Tuivasa. I like the complete game. I never thought I'd say that out of Tai Tuivasa. But again, if he can land the kicks, we've seen them from Hardy in the past, but he will kind of get away from them. And it just kind of gets a little bit instinctual when he's out there in the cage. But I do like Australia's Tuivasa in this fight. Both of us going with the man they call Bam Bam. We got two more big fights coming up. Welterweight Showcase, Burns, Wonderboy, both former title challengers at 170 pounds. And up at the top, both former champions. You've got Poirier taking on McGregor in the third installment of the trilogy. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Summer's coming. Are you ready to unveil your beach bod? If so, you're in luck with our friends at Manscaped. They just launched their fourth generation performance package, which includes the lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right. The 4.0, and it's the complement to your summer bod. And if you want to trim from the leaders in male grooming, the sun is shining. It's calling your name, fellas. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped and get ready for the hot guy summer that's going on. You got to go to manscaped.com. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP. Now, Matt, this is one of those times where I got to talk about trimming with Manscaped. And listen, with the 4.0, bang, just like that. Ceramic blade, LED light. And I've talked about it before. Now, I'm going to be traveling here in the next number of weeks. And you know for damn sure that if I 1, 2, 3 triple tap, it's going to have the travel lock on there. We've all been there and have had grooming accidents. But with Manscaped, they do a good job of eliminating some of those issues where you don't want to nick your nuts. And again, I'm sure we've all been there before. I know I've been there a time or two. But with the Lawnmower 4.0, it's really going to help that grooming game. The Performance Package 4.0, boom! I've got the t-shirt. Ow. I've also got the shed. And listen, you need a good toiletry bag. I know I'm definitely going to be using mine here coming up shortly. But it's time to bundle up. If you get that Performance Package 4.0, inside you're going to find that Lawnmower 4.0. The other thing that you're going to find, it's called the Weed Whacker. Now, Matt, I've got a lot of stuff in here, because you do in a toiletry bag. So it's going to take me some time to root around. Boomski's the Weed Whacker. You hear that?
One of the great demos you'll ever get.
I haven't whacked my ear in a while. And it also works if you have a lot of, I was going to say nose hair, but ear hair as well. You get the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. Now, the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant, it's right there. It goes on like a salve. Pop that stuff on and try not to drop your weed whacker. They also have the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. You spritz that stuff on, you're going to be good to go. But with that new performance package, again, the Lawnmower 4.0, it's really like the holy grail of trimming attachments out there. The travel lock works great if you want to lock it up, if you're going to put it in the shed for the week or for the weekend. And listen, they've got a 4000K LED spotlight. And we've all been there too. Shaving in the shower, and it's really hard to see what you're doing. That's an easy way to nick your nuts. This is going to be a great way to eliminate some of those issues. Both this and the Weed Whacker, they're both waterproof, so if you're a shower shaver, it's going to work perfectly for you. And if you want to seal the deal with Manscaped, you can check out some of their great salves, some of their great products over there. And if you're hanging out there too, they do have the Refined Clone. It's not a part of the Performance Package 4.0, but it is nice. You just spritz some of that on, walk through it, maybe waft it in. You're going to have a great smelling scent with you all day. So check them out, manscaped.com. There's going to be two free gifts in that Performance Package 4.0. The boxers, the shed travel bag. I just so happen to have the shirt anyway. I wear it around just like this. So get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Escape the shrubs and weeds this summer and shine with Manscaped. Matt, you have some parting thoughts for Manscaped?
You just want to be prepared in any situation. With the Total Performance Package, you know that you're going to be covered no matter what. You got hair below the belt? You're good. You got hair in your nose? You're good. You got hair in your ear? You're good. Even if you smell bad, they've got something for you too. So no matter what the situation, the Total Performance Package has got you covered.
Performance Package 4.0. Check it out. Manscaped.com. Promo code FNP. It hasn't changed. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. We got some big fights to talk about. Some big ones up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up at the UFC 264 co-main event from Vegas. We have Gilbert Burns taking on Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. Both of these guys, former title challengers. But I would hazard a guess that for Sanford MMA and Henry Hooft, he's going to have to sit Gilbert Burns down in between the first and second rounds. And Gilbert's going to go, are they saying boo? And well, Henry's going to have to say, no, sir. They're saying boo earns. Boo earns. But for Gilbert Burns, probably not going to be the favorite in this fight. Probably going to be Stephen Wonderboy Thompson in terms of the crowd reaction. But if there's a more affable, lovable guy out there, Gilbert Burns has to be there too. I mean, you look at the win streak that this guy went on when he moved from lightweight up to welterweight. You look at his last five fights. He beats Konchenko. He beats Gunnar Nelson. He beats Demian Maia. He beats the former champion of Tyron Woodley. And by MMA math alone, he beats Stephen Wonderboy for that fact, right? Well, maybe not. I mean, for Wonderboy, you look at it, the last five fights, he's got a win, and then he caps it off with two. But Jorge Masvidal, he loses to Darren Till in a close one. Did the English judging, did that
get
sway
dropped,
it a little
though.
Bit? He did get dropped. He gets knocked out by Pettis, and that was back in Nashville. Crazy to think that Anthony Pettis could knock anybody out these days. Apologies, Showtime. And then he beats Vicente Luque by decision, makes him look silly. And then he had a good fight against Jeff Neal, but he really did look good. I know he got a little cut up. His face wasn't the typical Wonder Boy loveliness, but listen, he looked amazing in that fight. So for Wonder Boy, he was able to kind of re-flip the script, especially at 38, coming off of those two losses to pick up two really big wins. For Gilbert Burns, now he has to kind of do the same thing. He really picked himself up when he came into this division, loses to Usman. He did have success in that fight until he didn't.
This is a must-win for both guys for many, many reasons. But for Wonderboy, this is it. Like, this is probably your last chance at getting one of these title eliminator-type fights. Because Wonderboy's the only guy in the top 10 who hasn't fought Usman yet. When you really go through the list, it's okay. He's fought Covington, he's fought Woodley, he's fought Burns. Like, he's fought a lot of those top guys. Wonderboy isn't on his resume. And it is weird because Wonderboy is one half of one of those fights that got away. And it was Wonderboy versus Demian Maia. That's a fight that never happened, but personally, I really wanted to see it because you have Wonderboy, who's a 10 out of 10 in striking, doesn't even go for takedowns, and then Demian Maia, basically the polar opposite. This is kind of that fight, though, and that's what makes it so exciting, especially for me as a fan to watch, because Wonderboy, he's got such great distance management, and that's the first thing you always have to bring up when you talk about Wonderboy. It's the footwork. It's not the karate. It is the footwork, because his evasiveness is almost an offensive tactic in its own right. Because something that people bring up a lot when they talk about Vasily Lomachenko is the fact that he has defensive pressure, to where he's always on you, but when you swing, you just swing at air. He can get out so well. That's exactly what Wonderboy did against Vicente Luque. And listen, you will not find someone waving that Vicente Luque flag more than me, but like, Wonderboy just beat him to the punch over and over and over again. And that was the first fight that I looked at after his last two losses. And I thought, wow, Wonderboy could be the champ depending on who they match him up with. And I do think this is one of those cases, because for Gilbert Burns, the one thing that he has been improving on, especially since his move up to 170, has been his striking. We all knew how good his grappling was. And the thing that we were talking about for seemingly years up until he became like a championship quality fighter was that, hey, if this guy could just put it all together one day, he would be a nightmare. And it did seem like he was starting to put everything together. He mixed the wrestling and with his output and with his power, with his jiu-jitsu, it's just a handful to deal with. But this fight against Wonderboy is interesting because it's really going to eliminate a lot of Gilbert Burns' weapons just in the beginning of the fight. Like, I don't think Gilbert Burns can land that that body kick from the southpaw position that we know that he's really good at. I do think a lot of the kicks of Gilbert Burns' arsenal are actually just going to be completely taken out, because against a guy like Wonder Boy, if you're throwing kicks and especially missing over and over and over again, that's a lot of energy that you are exerting. And I know that Gilbert Burns has really good cardio, don't get me wrong. And I'm not really worried about either guy's cardio in this fight. But if anybody's going to start to wear down as this third round goes on, or as the third round goes on, it's going to be Gilbert Burns. Because he's the one who's going to have to either A, get this fight to the mat, or B, just switch it up at some point. Because if Gilbert Burns finds himself behind in the striking, he's going to have to go for the takedown. Whereas if Wonderboy finds himself behind in the striking, there's really nothing you can do to get back in the fight.
And if you look at this one, I mean, for Wonderboy, he picked up a performance bonus over Jeff Neely, picked up a fight of the night against Vicente Luque, where he lit him up, both unanimous decision wins. He hasn't been taken down since he fought Tyron Woodley back in 2017. So it's absolutely insane to think about that. He has very, very good takedown defense, what, 78% over his career, which has lasted since he fought Dan Stichkin way back at UFC 143, Diaz versus Condit, in February of 2012. Knockout of the night bonus there. He's got performance, 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 fight of the night. He has so many bonuses. And for Gilbert Burns, again, a very, very special fighter. Obviously coming off his title shot where he took on Usman. He rocked him there on the feet at one point. He gets dropped a couple of times. It was kind of a tough one to watch. But before that fight, performance bonus when he beat Tyron Woodley by decision. Performance bonus when he knocked out Demian Maia. He also had performance bonuses over Alex Oliveira and Christos Yagos back at 155 pounds. He went on a weird stretch, and we talked about it. A lot of it weight cut related, the issues that he did have, but also bringing together his complete game. You can see it from the splits. Obviously, Wonderboy, a much better striker than Burns, but Burns is improving the striking, and Burns, the much more adept at trying to get the fight to the mat. So the real question is, can Burns strike to get the fight to the mat? That's going to be a big key.
He seems confident in his ability to, and this does worry me. Like, remember, I forget what it was, Paul Craig in his last fight when he fought Jamal Hill. Jamal Hill said, hey, he's good at grappling, but I've got a bunch of coaches over there who are really good at grappling too. And I've been with them for a long time. Gilbert Burns is kind of saying that with his striking right now, and it does worry me a little bit, because if there's any knock against the overall game of Gilbert Burns, is his durability. He's not the most durable guy in the world. If Gilbert Burns had the durability of Justin Gaethje, he'd probably never lose an MMA fight, because at some point there is going to be a weakness in your game, and if we have seen any, it is the fact that if you can clip Burns clean, he will go down. And I do agree with you that a lot of that at 155 might have been weight cut related, but I do think that there's a bit of a sample size to this point where at 170, he does struggle to eat clean shots. And against a guy like Wonderboy, like, what if we drop Vicente Luque? I know that might not sound like a big deal, but that's a big deal. Like, Luque's got one of the best chins in the UFC, and the fact that Wonderboy was able to not only drop him, but evade his shots and then make him pay for it, which is a really impressive performance from Wonderboy. And again, I do think this fight is one of those stylistic mismatches where Gilbert Burns might be confident in his striking, but I really do see this as the grappler taking on the striker. I think if Gilbert Burns could get this fight to the ground, and this is what I should say, as much as I've given Wonderboy credit for his striking, if Gilbert Burns gets this fight to the mat, and I know it's hard to get Wonderboy down, but if he takes it down one time, he'll probably submit him. Like, that is the night and day difference these guys have in their styles, where the advantage that Wonderboy has in the feet is almost dwarfed by the advantage that Burns has on the mat, because we've seen Burns out-grapple guys who are collegiate wrestlers, who are black belts in jiu-jitsu, guys who have much better grappling credentials than Wonderboy has, and he's passed with flying colors. So for me, it does come down to, do I think Burns can get the takedown? Personally, I don't think he can. I actually do think Gilbert Burns is going to find himself striking with Wonderboy throughout the majority of this fight. And the power of Burns may be able to be the equalizer in some exchanges. Maybe there's an exchange where Wonderboy lands three shots, but Burns lands one big one. And you're like, oh, is Wonderboy hurt? The problem is that I've only seen Wonderboy get knocked out one time. And that one time was a beautiful shot from Showtime. But it was an isolated incident. Like, he's been hurt by guys, but he's only ever been put down that one time. And I do think Wonderboy is a much faster fighter than Gilbert Burns, and I think Pettis is a faster fighter than Burns. So for me, final prediction, I think at 170, without a doubt, Anthony Pettis is a faster fighter than Gilbert Burns.
Not anymore.
At 170, he is a faster fighter than Gilbert Burns when he fought Wonderboy, without a doubt. I do think Wonderboy is going to win this fight, but personally, I see the winner of this fighting for the title.
I look at this fight, and for Wonderboy, it's something that we talked about before, but again, you want to see somebody that fights, and you see the silhouette of them, you see them in the mirror, holy smokes, wow, this is really something special. For Wonderboy, you know exactly who it is. You put him behind a curtain, oh, okay, that's Steve Wonderboy Thompson. But the neat thing is, when he goes from Orthodox to Southpaw, totally different strikes. And we see that. We talk about certain fighters are the ambidextrous, like with Ciryl Gane. When he switches over to southpaw, when he switches from orthodox and back and forth, you see some of the same shots. He's one of the most cerebral strikers out there. Wonderboy's on that level, but he does it differently. So if he switches over to southpaw, he might throw a question mark kick with his right leg. If he switches over to orthodox, he might throw a leg kick with his lead leg, with his left foot. So you see a lot of differences from Wonderboy that way. I think he's got to camouflage those in, but really try and change the angles that he's hitting Burns at to really make him desperate to have to shoot for those panic takedowns. And then it's just the Wonderboy show all over again. So it is a really tricky fight. But when I look at the odds for this one, Wonderboy opened a plus 135. The line dropped automatically and reset itself. He's a minus 165 favorite right now. For Burns, the opposite. Open a minus 155. He's a plus 133. And if we head on over to Tapology, you have 1,548 total votes, 73% Thompson, 75% by decision for the 27% that have Burns. 42% by decision, 25% by submission, 25% by knockout. So it's a lot of fun that way, but yeah, I've got Wonderboy in this one.
I know Burns and Luque are close friends, so maybe they can exchange notes and somehow get a really good game plan together for Wonderboy. And I don't doubt it. Like, Sanford MMA is probably going to have a pretty good game plan to fight Wonderboy Thompson. I don't doubt that. Again, I do like the overall footwork and the movement of Wonderboy, because what's the best way to defend a takedown? Never let your opponent get close to you to begin with, and that's really the epitome of Wonderboy's game, so I almost have to pick him in this fight.
Absolutely love this fight, and I'd love nothing more to be wrong in this one, because wouldn't it be great if we got to see Burns and Usman too, but
I'd rather see Wonderboy Usman 1.
I'd like to see Wonderboy Usman 1 too. Both of us going with Simpsonville's own Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. Let us know below who you're going with in this fight. If you haven't tossed a like and a sub, I know I'd appreciate it, wouldn't you?
I would. It'd be very
Matt,
very nice.
We have a big time main event coming up. The trilogy, the third leg of Poirier versus McGregor. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
It's finally time for our main event of the evening, the third leg of the trilogy between Dustin the Diamond Poirier. He's taking on the notorious Conor McGregor. And Matt, this is such an interesting fight. There's so many different talking points coming into this one, because if you go way back to their first fight, it was at featherweight. It was about 7 years ago, and McGregor was dynamite at the time. It was on his way up through his rise in the featherweight division. He beats Mendez. He then beats Jose Aldo. He's the greatest featherweight of all time. He goes up to lightweight. He wins the belt against Eddie Alvarez. Peppered in between that, a couple of fights with Nate Diaz. But when you focus on it, the career, the achievements, the fight against Mayweather, one of the biggest stars that combat sports has ever seen. And in the time between the second fight and this fight coming up this weekend, McGregor, co-founders Adi Atara and Ken Austin sold their majority stake in Proper 12 to Proximo Spirits for about $600 million. Proximo had previously owned 49%. McGregor goes out, buys the bar that he may or may not have allegedly hit that old
guy. Well, he did.
It's a Black Forge Inn. And now he's running that empire. And for Conor McGregor, I don't know, he runs amok on Instagram. He's kind of kept things on the down low before this fight, but he has had some major business dealings. And for Dustin Poirier, well, he already had the hot sauce, and that's still a thing.
It's good, too.
And he's been in the gym, and that's pretty much all I've seen. So for Poirier, he came out the winner in their second fight. I know the big talking point is the fact that the leg kicks were the difference. Will we see McGregor come out here in that famous karate stance that he made so famous? I can't tell you that. I honestly don't know, but I have had a decent sample size out of the first two fights and their entire careers. Poirier making it as far as interim champ at lightweight. Obviously, McGregor, double champ status back in 2016. But that's the trouble. His last win at lightweight, November 12th of 2016. And as I said in the intro, the number one song in the world at that time was Closer by the Chainsmokers and Halsey. Will McGregor be able to get a win coming up? It's really tough to tell, but I do love the fight. It is a great one.
It's a weird fight. Let's just call it what it is. This is an odd trilogy that kind of has to be made, but not really. It's weird because, okay, I understand what the UFC is doing right now. Dustin Poirier right now is the number one ranked lightweight in the world. He's not Charles Oliveira, but a lot of people assume if he wins this fight, he will be fighting Charles Oliveira next to the title. Good? We're all good with those facts?
Sure.
Then why is Conor McGregor fighting in a title eliminator? It makes sense, don't get me wrong. And I do think that he showed enough in their second fight. I keep on wanting to say first fight. He showed enough in their second fight that I think McGregor could beat guys in the top 10 at lightweight. Don't get me wrong. It's just you can't have him fight fighter X in the top 10 of the lightweight rankings. Because this is the problem. If you lose to Dustin Poirier again for the second time out of your three fights, it's not the end of the world. Poirier himself is a big star now, and he's a very, very good fighter who has a very wide, broad appeal outside of just the MMA world. Whereas McGregor, he needs this win. Like, if he loses this one, I don't really know what his excuse can be. And this is the other thing that I kind of have to keep on going back constantly is, McGregor really got a lot of people into MMA because of his trash talk. He was such an electrifying and magnetic persona that you just wanted to hear what he had to say. I know that it was a big talking point where, like, okay, him and Dustin, they're kind of friendly going into the second fight. There's not this animosity, but, like, it's just odd. It doesn't feel like it's the same guy anymore. And I was thinking this going into their second fight, but if their second fight proved anything, it's just Conor McGregor now isn't the same guy he was in 2016. And there's no shame in that. Like, you're probably not the same you were. I know I'm not. It's just people change after 6 years. And for Conor McGregor, close to $1 billion and year and 6 years of being a professional athlete are really, really, really going to change your career and just your outlook on MMA. And I know I sound a lot like Robin Black right now, but this is the last point I have. I understand Conor McGregor's fans are very passionate and they appreciate everything he's done, not just for MMA as a sport, but just for Irish athletics on a global scale. This is the weird thing I have with Conor McGregor. We brought this up before the videos, and this is more of an open-ended discussion. Dustin Poirier will train with unranked Bellator fighters and not post a single thing on his Instagram. You don't know unless you're, like, on that fighter's page and they post something about it in their story. And no one says anything about it. And like you had mentioned, he sells his hot sauce, he goes to the gym. Conor McGregor will post one picture of him on a bike and people are like, wow, he's in shape now. I've never seen him like this. Like, it just, there's a weird psychology that always goes on when it is a Conor McGregor fight. And it always feels like people are finally saying, this is the best version. This is the best version. I've heard this is the best version of McGregor before the Khabib fight, before the first Nate fight, before the second Nate fight, and before the second Poirier fight. He looked human and beatable in all of those fights, and I just don't think that we're talking about the same guy now that we were talking about back when he did beat Poirier.
It's really weird for me, because what I do when I do all the research, it's a big deep dive. You do the social media, you do the videos that the teams have been putting out, you do the videos that the UFC has been putting out, and when I look at it, this is all before the UFC's countdown is out, so this hinges on all of that. But from the Conor McGregor, I don't see a lot of SBG Ireland. I don't see a lot of John Kavanaugh. I know Conor and John Kavanaugh have had a really interesting relationship with amateur MMA in Ireland with their contributions there, so you love to see it. But I've seen a lot of McGregor in California in pictures by himself, which is really weird. Like, it's just no Lobov, like, no James Gallagher, who has taken his talents to Glory MMA and Fitness, which is kind of odd.
But also, remember that time he lied about donating $500,000? And he did
do it. Or did he?
Well, no, he said he was going to give it to Poirier's organization. I don't care who gets the money. It's just like, there's always an oh, by the way, it feels like, when it comes to Conor McGregor. And that's always the stage of a combat athlete's career where you do start to have question marks. Like, for instance, Manny Pacquiao was going to fight Errol Spence Jr. And Manny Pacquiao was a great fighter. Manny Pacquiao in 2016 may have made that a competitive fight. The issue is that that fight is being booked in 2021. Errol Spence Jr. is going to do horrible things to Manny Pacquiao. But that fight is going to be sold with the promise that Manny Pacquiao was a great thing and he can still be that great thing.
And might have to fight McGregor. We'll see how that one plays out. But when I look at this one, it is tricky because you saw the way that their second fight played out. So I threw it out there in the community tab on YouTube. And if you know, you know, and 1900 of you have in the last day, 55% of Poirier to win, 45% have McGregor to win. So if we throw it on over to Tapology, let's see how it shakes out. 63% of 1599 total votes have Poirier, 37% have McGregor. So the Tapology fans, there's a little bit more in Poirier's corner. The Fight Night Picks fans, maybe a little bit less, but it is a close enough fight. Now, in that first one, like you said, you did see some flashes out of McGregor a little bit, but it was mostly Poirier. I know McGregor at certain points was able to back Poirier up behind the black lines. You like to see that. Not a lot of fighters have a lot of success when they're backed up that way. Only Poirier did a lot of great work in tight in that fight, right?
It's really odd. This is, again, it's always the narrative. And the narrative is just a term that you're going to hear a lot this week. Why did Conor McGregor say he only lost that fight because of the leg kicks? Like, it's just, it's a weird thing to say. We all watched. Millions of people did. And the weirder thing is that people defend him, too. He's like, oh, my leg gave out. You also got hit by a check right hook because you drop your left hand when you go for right straight shots, and Dustin Poirier capitalized on that effect. Like, this is the problem. Conor McGregor is a very good boxer, and I know people talk about karate stance and all that. Conor McGregor doesn't really fight with the karate stance in MMA. People got to know this. Like, he did when he knocked out Jose Aldo because of that one strike. Look at the Nate fights. Does he fight like this in the Nate fights? Not at all. He fights slightly more upright and moves forward a lot and boxes a lot in those fights. We're talking about a fighter 10 pounds ago and, like, 6 years ago might have been competitive in this spot. It's just, it's weird. And him with the whole, like, oh, first person to go for a takedown is a bitch. Like, Rudy Gobert won Defensive Player of the Year, and he's really, really good at blocking shots. But that'd be like if Rudy Gobert went, hey, Steph Curry, don't shoot threes or pass the ball. You have to run at me straight forward every single time and give me the best chance of winning. It's just weird. Like, if you're McGregor, why wouldn't you just be like, hey, I made a mistake, but I'm going to fix that, and then I'm going to beat the brakes off you because I had success in these few areas. Like, if McGregor wanted to say, I landed straight left hands. He did. Like, McGregor still landed good shots in their second fight. Again, I keep on wanting to say their first. He landed good shots in their second fight, and he did do a decent job in their second fight. It's just the excuses. Those are the things that really worry me. If he just came out and was like, yeah, I need to work on this stuff, we heard about what he had to work on, and then he showed up at fight week seeming ready, I would feel a lot more comfortable saying that we're going to see a different version of Conor McGregor. I just feel like we're going to see the exact same fighter this weekend that we did see going into their second fight.
I think we might end up seeing some wrinkles, and I talked about it a little bit earlier, but you have those solo shots in, what is it, like, hashtag my gym in California, and okay, that's a little weird. Probably doesn't want to give up who his training partners are. Huge wealth of talent in California, and you're going to fly guys in anyway. So I am actually really eager to see those countdown shows, because normally we tape this after the countdown, but very shortly after. You digest it a little bit, and then you go off on your point. So I'm eager to see that. But for me, again, I have a look at the odds. They flip-flopped since they opened. Dustin Poirier opened a plus 120. He's a minus 120 favorite. McGregor opened a minus 140. He's about a minus 101 or thereabouts. For me, it's almost too soon. So I do like Poirier in this spot again. And I like Poirier by finish again. And I know where you're going to go with it, so I'll let you take it away.
I'm going to throw in one wrinkle. This is the only way I see Conor McGregor winning, so let me say this first. When Kamaru Usman beat Jorge Masvidal, it was because Jorge Masvidal is an orthodox fighter, and he threw a left check hook. When he threw his left check hook, he dropped his right hand, which left a wide open avenue for Kamaru Usman to land a huge straight right through the opening that Jorge Masvidal made. Okay? Two orthodox fighters, remember this. We're going to switch it to southpaw. Both of these guys are southpaw. Dustin Poirier trains at the same gym Jorge Masvidal does. Poirier has a really good check right hook. Now, this is the one difference. Poirier does do a really good job, and I will say technically I think he is a better boxer than Jorge Masvidal, but he is a guy who is a very big fan of that check right hook. And if Conor McGregor can time a left straight coming right down the center, he might be able to land that shot. That is the one area I think Conor McGregor might be able to. If he can put a lot behind that one straight left, I do think you might see one of those situations where he goes straight, Poirier throws a curve, and Conor McGregor lands first. My official prediction, I think Poirier is going to win by submission, oddly enough. I know I've been saying this for a long time. Dustin Poirier is a black belt Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but nobody talks about it. Like, Jose Aldo had always felt like people would mention it. They'd be like, don't take him down because he's good there, but people couldn't in the first place. With Poirier, when you actually see him grapple in MMA, he is very good at it.
Like, whispers of Anthony Pettis.
Well, no, like, he beat the brakes off Anthony Pettis on the mat, and he completely out-grappled Dan Hooker, and I would consider those guys, like, good MMA grapplers. We just saw him get out-grappled by Khabib. Other than Khabib, I don't think a lot of guys can go out there and just out-grapple Poirier. Like, maybe Charles Oliveira, but other than those two guys who I would consider like all-time great grapplers, I do think he can hold his own with a lot of those guys. I think if he can get this fight into deep waters, he can eventually get that takedown like we saw in the first round against McGregor, and I do see a submission being likely for Poirier.
Matt, absolutely love this fight. We're both going with Louisiana's own Dustin Poirier to get the win in the rematch at 155. It's the third leg of the trilogy, and let us know down below what you're thinking. If you like the video, if you hate the video, if you want to subscribe, you should toss us a like anyway. Make sure you check out our other content on the channel. We've got great interviews, great podcasts as well. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, as well as our new venture. We opened another two boxes of the Panini Prizm UFC cards. You can find us at 15-minute card breaks. Exciting. So make sure you check that one out. There's a link down below in the description. We're going to be breaking all different kinds of sports cards over there. Because, hey, sometimes we're not just MMA guys, but we are hardcore MMA guys. Can't wait for this weekend's card. 2 hours before the prelims, we will have question mark kicks. We offer up our final picks and predictions. Just wait until about Friday before that thumbnail drops. Make sure you hit the bell notification so you do know when we go live, because there's a lot of stragglers near the end of those shows that are absolutely frazzled. We'll also have the fight companion for the main card. If you miss the reaction for the Poirier win, holy smokes, you're going to want to go back and check that one out. But Matt, I absolutely love this card top to bottom. I can't wait for the action to get going. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.